You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu Baraka is national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace. He's a human rights defender whose experience spans four decades of domestic and international education and activism. He's provided human rights trainings for activists across the country, briefings on human rights to the U.S. Congress, and appeared before and provided statements to various U.N. agencies. Baraka was the founding executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. He held various leadership positions at Amnesty International USA, including directing the program to abolish the death penalty. He's served on the boards of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Africa Action, the Mississippi Workers' Center for Human Rights. He's taught political science at universities and been a guest lecturer in the U.S. and abroad. He's an editor and columnist at Black Agenda Report and at Counterpunch. He ran for vice president on the Green Party ticket, and he and I both spoke at a recent conference of the United National Anti-War Coalition. Ajamu Baraka, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
David, it is a pleasure and really an honor to be with you on this program.
It's wonderful to have you on and to see the work that you're doing with the Black Alliance for Peace. People can check it out at blackallianceforpeace.com. You start out there saying the Black Alliance for Peace seeks to recapture and redevelop the historic anti-war, anti-imperialist, and pro-peace positions of the radical Black movement. Do you want to talk about that and the origins for this new alliance?
Well, you know, that I think that comment kind of captures what we are trying to do. That if you look at the sectors of the population that have been the most consistently anti-war, you have to kind of identify the Black population as really one of the most consistent. Black folks have always had a deep a suspicion, if you will, at minimum questioning attitude when it came to U.S. Foreign policies. Because of our experiences in this country, we've always had a deep opposition to militarism. We've always had a very pro-peace component of our culture because of our religious and spiritual orientations. You know, all that adds up to a population that has been in the forefront of advocating for peace, for social justice, and for being opposed to all forms of war. So that is a sentiment that's been predominant in our community and has been, I think, a very important part of what we call the Black radical tradition, having a pro-peace, anti-war, anti-imperialist position that we are seeking to try to recapture. We know that this is a moment to, in fact, do that because of the fact that people are now thinking again critically. We know that in the Black community there was a slight shift to the right as a consequence of the policies legitimization of those policies, of state policies by the Obama administration that move Black opinion somewhat to the right, but that now with the ascendancy of Donald Trump, people are sort of coming out of this kind of fog of confusion and thinking again. So we think this is the right moment to revive that traditional position and to reaffirm that position, but to also contextualize, ground this effort in the need for rebuilding the broader anti-war, anti-imperialist movement here in the U.S.
Yeah. As we're recording this on Monday, the U.S. Conference of Mayors has just passed resolutions following the lead of several cities saying to Congress, move the money out of the military into human and environmental needs, the opposite of what Trump has proposed. So there seems to be some openness to that position at the local level. And the Black Lives Matter movement seems to have a great
policy position on war. How do we connect, you know, local activism with international activism?
Well, we have to connect it by connecting by helping people to understand the absolute inability to disconnect those two levels of activism and concern. That you can't be concerned about the local conditions, state services, state investment in the support of people, and not understanding how that is impacted by decisions being made on the national or federal level. And that when you have decisions being made on the national level in which resources are shifted away from addressing the basic material needs of people and toward war instead, then, you know, you begin to understand much clearer why we have these austerity policies on a local level. You begin to understand the direct impact between militarism and the shifting of public resources toward militarism on the national level, and the inability to address those basic material human needs that people have on the local level. So that connection has to be made. We can no longer afford to engage in activism, and to engage in politics, in which those connections aren't being made. Because if we don't, then we'll find ourselves not just spinning our wheels, but inadvertently supporting policies and supporting governments that are against our interests and also the interests of millions of people around the world. So being good citizens, if you will, good global citizens, being morally accountable requires that we go beyond the kind of U.S. centrism that we have seen emerge here in this country over the last decade or so. We are global citizens, and we have global responsibilities and global accountability.
We are speaking with Ajamu Baraka, who's the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu, at that conference we were at recently, Glenn Ford made a couple of points I found interesting. One, that during Obama's presidency was the first time that blacks outpolled whites in terms of support for a war, in what they tell pollsters. And he noted that the whites in the United States who voted for Donald Trump, willing or if not eager to support his racist positions, were not turned away by his anti-war rhetoric, false as it may have been. Is the problem that war is just not the top of the agenda for anyone, and things like party and race and other policies outweigh it?
Well, you know, I think that the point that Glenn was making was that the public is really prepared for a new kind of politics. That this idea that people are going to automatically support warmongering just doesn't seem to hold up. That when there is a new direction, even when it's articulated by someone as right-wing as Donald Trump, you see that it resonates somewhat. It's just the failure on the part of leadership, the failure on the part of progressive leadership to understand where the American people are and to begin to articulate new directions. And one reason why they're unable to do that, those leaders who are connected to the Democratic Party, is because of the internal corruption of that party and their embracing the agenda and the perspectives of some very powerful elements of the oligarchy that find it very profitable to engage in the war business. So the people, I think, are prepared for a new direction. The problem we have, of course, is that they're not being provided the leadership. And that because of this constant drumbeat toward war that they are exposed to from the corporate press, those numbers of people who are really exhausted and really open to more anti-war and pro-peace positions, those numbers aren't as great as I think they could be if we had a different kind of political environment, different kind of leadership. I mean, even with some of the most progressive leaders, people like Bernie Sanders, who have, you know, very progressive positions in terms of domestic policies, but still find it very difficult to go the next step, like folks in the UK, to say, look, we also are going to question and oppose those policies that are perpetuating war and violence from our own state.
Yeah. I looked at I think there have been three special elections for Congress since the Trump Hillary Clinton election, and the Republicans have won all three in, I think, Georgia and Montana and Kansas. And I looked at those three Republicans' websites, and they've all got pro-military, pro-war, anti-immigrant, pro-Israel, positions spelled out on their websites. And I looked at the three Democrats who lost at their websites, and there's nothing. There's just, like, foreign policy just doesn't exist. It's the, yeah, you know, 60% of the job, but they just have no position on it whatsoever. Is that something you can point out to Democrats and they'll fix it? Or is it, you know, what drives that?
Well, I don't think they're going to fix it, because right now it's they perceive it to be in their interest not to comment.
But they lose. But they lose every time.
They do, and they seem not to be learning any lessons from that, including progressive folks who caucus with the Democratic Party, like Bernie Sanders. That people are ready for a stronger pro-peace position. That people are tired of the violence that has consumed our lives and consumed the lives of people around the world. But they just don't seem to see that yet. And that's why I think this moment is really so pregnant with possibilities in terms of rebuilding the anti-war position, that they are numbers of people that are prepared to at least examine the possibility of new relationships with various cities, I mean various regimes, that they are open to the idea that we could use diplomacy to address some of these issues that the oligarchy and their leaders are suggesting can only be resolved by violence and war. It's just a matter of us articulating those positions in a clear way. We shouldn't expect that to come from the Democrat Party as it is presently constituted. Now, there are some elements that can, in fact, raise those issues but within the Democratic Party, but they're not even doing it. Even, you know, the insurgents within the Democrat Party. So, you know, it's going to take a third force, if you will, a revived anti-war movement to build the kind of popular support to galvanize those elements of the population that are sick and tired of war, to put pressure on their representatives to take more forthright, clear, moral positions against the insanity of U.S. policies as it stands today.
Yeah. Looking through your incredible biography, Jamu, I see, you know, reference time and again to trying to hold the United States to international standards on human rights. How would we do that on war and peace? And what would it look like for the world to hold the United States to the rule of law in that area? I mean, you've worked to abolish the death penalty. Should we be working to abolish war as a criminal enterprise? And how can we?
I think that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that would be an agenda for. I think that would be the centerpiece of an agenda of individuals, movements that are concerned with the advancement of the collective humanity, that this scourge of war has to be front and center for abolition. So the way that looks in the U.S. right now is for us to demand, at minimum, that U.S. decision makers are governed by the rule of international law, as flawed as that might be. But there are structures and standards coming out of the UN process that the U.S. has decided that it's going to completely ignore. The very fact that we have a U.S. presence in Syria, for example, is in contradiction to all international norms and standards. The very fact that the U.S. can engage in unilateral military operations, even though they may justify it in terms of some kind of moral position, the fact that they are engaging in these activities outside of the framework of the Security Council, these are all violations of standard international norms and laws. So at minimum, you know, we should demand that the U.S. Adhere to the structures and the legal framework that they helped to put in place as a consequence of pressure coming from the public, of course. But this is the standard that we have to demand of all nations. It has to be one standard for all nations. So that's the first first point. The second point is, you know, we have to have a continued conversation around what kind of society and what kind of people do we want to be. Are we going to continue to allow almost, if you look at the proposals from the Trump administration to increase the military budget by more than $50 billion, $54 billion to be exact, the question becomes, you know, are we going to use almost 60% of all of our discretionary resources, budget, for pursuing, war and violence? So, you know, I think that we are able to engage the people. I think that, you know, we could make some inroads in terms of the lack of opposition to these kinds of proposals. And that's why, for the Black Alliance for Peace, one of our most immediate areas of work is to, in fact, oppose the budget proposals by Donald Trump. So these two points, I think, are critical, that there's a anti-war, a latent anti-war position that we can organize, and that, secondly, I think that we can organize that anti-war position by helping to focus people's attention on the squandering of resources that are being proposed by this proposal from Donald Trump to increase military spending, and by looking critically at the entire military budget and proposing, like the Green Party and like the Moving for Black Lives Matter, that we should, as a beginning point, reduce military expenditures by 50% and transfer those resources to addressing the social and material needs of people here in this country.
I couldn't agree more. And there's some groups that have been pushing for these city resolutions and the Conference of Mayors that are now going to start pushing state legislators to make the same demand of Congress. And I'll email you later in case you want to collaborate on that. But this legal question keeps bugging me. That I think if another nation were to attack some other state, we wouldn't have human rights groups pointing out particular atrocities. We would have the whole thing denounced as a crime, as an act of aggression, as a violation of the UN Charter. I mean, none of these half dozen wars the U.S. is now in are legal under the UN Charter or under the Kellogg-Briand Pact, are they?
Well, they really aren't. And one of the reasons why we haven't had more outcry from the public and from various human rights organizations is that, you know, the way these wars have been framed, the human rights community helped to provide the tool that the U.S. and others have used to justify war and intervention, and that is this notion of humanitarian intervention.
Yeah.
And from that, this responsibility to protect. Both in the abstract are really marvelous concepts, but the way they have been implied, have been used concretely,
yeah,
they have been used in the interest of power, of perpetuating dominance. And therefore, the human rights organizations have found themselves sort of have painted themselves into almost like an ideological corner When the U.S. and others are using this notion of the responsibility to protect against these dictators and this and that, it becomes very difficult for some of these groups to take a principled opposition on those questions. What they then reduce to is looking at some of the technical implementation issues around disproportionate force and those kinds of technical issues. But the larger moral issue, they have undermined themselves by, in fact, providing these kind of tools for these dominant forces to justify their aggression.
Yeah, very, very well said. I couldn't agree more. I want to ask you about a point on the Black Alliance for Peace website that I may disagree with, and I ask this respectfully and wanting to learn. But Principles of Unity, I think, and the very first sentence is, Black Alliance for Peace is not a pacifist movement. I'm wondering what you are supporting in rejecting pacifism.
Well, you know, that's actually interesting that you raise that, because we're having some conversations with some of our allies and friends around what, in fact, we are trying to get at there and how that might be read. Now, the original intent of that was that that groups that may affiliate with this alliance are not going to have to commit themselves to a position, a popular understanding of what pacifism is supposed to be. There are people that are oppressed, who may utilize various forms of resistance that may not be completely identified and associated with the principles of nonviolence or pacifism, and that as an alliance, we need to come to some kind of conclusion as to how we relate to that, and whether or not that's going to be something that will be activities or positions that might not be in alignment with our principles. So this is a point that we've had to continue to discuss and debate, but it just was put in place there to provide an opportunity for folks who may not have the same position or issues of pacifism or whatever to be a part of that conversation.
Yeah, yeah, it's very tricky because I don't want to tell people my government is attacking how they should or shouldn't resist it. You know, I want to focus on telling my government to stop it. But if you're supporting war and you're making arguments for war by others, you know, it tends to support the idea in the minds of people in the United States that there are arguments for war. And there's millions of Americans who think war is a necessary defensive tool that they, you know, that they see logical grounds for supporting. And it's hard for me to strip those away while supporting the idea that war is good for other people. You know,
Well, you know, David, that's a very important discussion, because I think for myself, I think that the notion of states involving themselves in any type of aggressive war is really an anachronism, that this should be eliminated. But there are, in fact, situations where there are people who are oppressed, who may, for whatever reasons, feel compelled to engage in activities that you and I may not would wish that they didn't have to engage in, but that they feel compelled to, in fact, engage in a resistance that has a military component. I don't feel morally in a position to be able to tell any oppressed people that they cannot utilize whatever tools they believe are available to, in fact, change their conditions. Now, I think it's important for some people to take an absolute position on that. I think that kind of moral position, I think, is legitimate and needs to be articulated. But, you know, for myself, I couldn't really take that position. I mean, I want to, at every point, try to avoid conflict and avoid violence. I mean, no sane person really wants to engage in that. I mean, even people who are oppressed. But I think it'd be very difficult for me morally to suggest to people that there are neck conditions that exist that you know, might justify in their minds them having to engage in a very in forms of resistance that we might not completely agree with.
Yeah, very good. I think people should go and read the website at blackallianceforpeace.com. There's a great list of short-term and longer-term goals there as well, including opposing Trump's budget, the war in Syria, the war in Yemen, militarization of police, working with black movements in Colombia. How are you going to go about working on all these different areas? What kind of organization are you building here?
Well, you see that we have short-term, immediate, and longer-term sort of programmatic goals.
Yeah.
The short-term, we are focused really on just a few areas that I think are of immediate importance. One, of course, is opposing the continued slaughter in Yemen by the Saudis with the full support of the U.S. We think that is absolutely critical. We have a humanitarian crisis that, you know, people are really not speaking to. And we've, as black folks and human beings, human rights defenders, we feel compelled to comment on that and to oppose it. The expanded presence of the U.S. in Syria and the dangerous situation in that country that could lead to a confrontation with Russia, and who knows what happens from that. I think we are politically and morally compelled to work on that right now, because it's really one of the major threats.
Yeah,
you know, we have a responsibility to connect up the anti-war position with what is happening domestically, and this continuation of militarizing the police forces through this 1033 program, and again, is another sort of immediate task that we have to take up. So, you know, these few things right there are, and then of course, you know, the budget. And
yeah,
those four items are the things that we think we have to take up right now. And we're not going to try to overly extend ourselves as we build this alliance with you know, working on all of the myriad issues we could be working on. We want to keep the focus on these few items. We believe that this notion of expanding the military budget and the dependency on militarism by the oligarchy provides a political opportunity for us to really raise these issues and to put a stop to some of this activity. So
we're going to build
an alliance, and we think that we're going to focus on these four areas as a foundation for building that alliance.
I think it's the right agenda. If there's any ways I can help with it, let me know. I wish we could go another hour, but the clock has run out on us. Jammu Baraka, you can check out his website online and blackallianceforpeace.com. Thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, The policy that said that hundreds of non-citizen Muslim, Arab, and South Asian men should be locked up and treated as suspected terrorists, despite no evidence of that in the wake of the September 11th attacks, came from the highest levels of government. That's why a suit brought on behalf of some of those men sought damages from top officials, including former Attorney General John Ashcroft. The Supreme Court has just denied the men's right to sue those officials. What does that mean for accountability when powerful people make unconstitutional policy? We'll discuss that deeply relevant question with Rachel Mirapol, Senior Staff Attorney and Associate Director of Legal Training and Education at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Also on the show, analysts at Deloitte ascribed a cash value of $42.4 billion to the Great Barrier Reef. The world's largest coral reef system is threatened by climate change. The company said they hoped the assessment of its economic, social, and asset value would influence decision-making. It's disturbing that that's what was deemed necessary, but then outlets like CNN made matters worse, encouraging us to equate an irreplaceable ecosystem with the market share of GM, Honda, or BMW, or more than 12 Sydney opera houses. There are people covering the many stories of climate disruption more thoughtfully. We'll talk about some of the many stories to be told with environmental writer Dan Zukowski. His work appears in Enviro News, among other outlets. That's coming up, but first, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. If you know New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, you know he talks to a lot of cab drivers and he loves trade deals. Friedman has famously, and you might say fatuously, declared there's no need to even read such deals. "You know what?" he told a questioner at a public event. Quote, "I wrote a column supporting the CAFTA, the Caribbean Free Trade Initiative. I didn't even know what was in it. I just knew two words, free trade." Close quote. One can only imagine Friedman took the same proud disinterest in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, whose demise he laments in a June 28th piece. The TPP, he told readers, quote, "was the best ever for U.S. workers, closing loopholes NAFTA had left open. TPP included restrictions on foreign state-owned enterprises that dumped subsidized products into our markets, intellectual property protections for rising U.S. technologies, like free access for all cloud computing services, but also anti-human trafficking provisions that prohibited turning guest workers into slave labor, a ban on trafficking in endangered wildlife parts, a requirement that signatories permit their workers to form independent trade unions to collectively bargain, and the elimination of all child labor practices, all to level the playing field with American workers." Close quote. Economist Dean Baker addresses the multiple things Friedman gets wrong on FAIR.org. For a start, all of the provisions on items like human trafficking, child labor, and trading in endangered wildlife would have depended on action by the administration. That's the Trump administration. By contrast, the provisions on items like violations of the patent and copyright provisions or the investment rules could be directly enforced by the companies affected. The TPP created an extrajudicial process called the Investor-State Dispute Settlement System, which would determine if an investor's rights under the agreement had been violated by, say, an anti-pollution law. Baker calls bizarre Friedman's suggestion that increased intellectual property restrictions benefit U.S. workers. Patent and copyright protections are a kind of protectionism that, if anything, undermines most U.S. workers. They mean that foreign countries will pay more to Microsoft for its software or Pfizer for its drugs, which means they'd have less money to buy U.S. manufactured goods. Friedman uses his beloved words free trade four times in reference to the TPP. That's not just propagandistic, Baker explains. It's simply inaccurate, since the increased protections in the pact likely more than offset the tariff reductions. Interestingly, the projected gain to GDP of $130 billion by 2030 that Friedman cites, it comes from the strongly pro-TPP Peterson Institute for International Economics, doesn't take into account any negative impact from the increased copyright and patent-related protections. A model that did might plausibly show a loss to the U.S. from the TPP, and especially to the bulk of the workforce who wouldn't benefit from the protections. Oh, and all the talk about currency, the moves by China and others to prop up the dollar that led to those enormous trade deficits, the TPP includes nothing at all on the issue. There's a separate letter of understanding on currency that has no legal status. Friedman criticizes Donald Trump for rejecting the TPP without reading it, but his own remarks would suggest that he didn't read it either, and the fundamental errors in the column would tend to confirm that. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Supreme Court has just reversed a federal appeals court ruling that would have allowed former top officials to be held accountable for the violation of the rights of the hundreds of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian men swept up by programs and policies crafted by those officials in the wake of the September 11, 2001 attacks. Brought in on the strength of tips from people worried about the Arab-looking guy down the hall, men like the plaintiffs in Ziegler versus Abbasi had nothing to do with terrorism. There was no real reason to think they did. Nevertheless, they were locked away, abused grievously, with, in some cases, family and lawyers misled about where they were. After they were cleared of terrorism charges, the men were deported on immigration violations. The court didn't seem to disagree these men's rights were violated. So what did the ruling mean, and where do we go from here? Rachel Mirapol is a senior staff attorney and associate director of legal training and education at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She joins us by phone from here in New York. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rachel Mirapol.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, the view of the majority, such as it is, this was a 4-2 ruling. Kagan and Sotomayor recused themselves, and Gorsuch wasn't sitting yet when the case was heard. But the majority view was that bad things happened, but money damages aren't appropriate, or that damages aren't appropriate because we're talking about federal officials, and so it's not the court's role there. What was their thinking for reversing the ruling by the Second Circuit?
Well, that's right. Basically, what the majority in the Supreme Court held is that individuals whose constitutional rights are violated by federal officials simply cannot seek money damages from those officials when what they're complaining about was, you know, something different than a one-time spur-of-the-moment violation by a federal official. So the challenge in this case was to policies created after 9/11, policies to round up non-citizens based on religion, ethnicity, and race, investigate them for ties to terrorism, keep them in restrictive confinement conditions as if they were terrorists while this was happening. And the court ruled that that kind of policy decision is simply inappropriate for a damage remedy.
It's very interesting to say that the claims don't work against top officials because it's a matter of policy. You know, as if, well, if John Ashcroft had punched one of these guys in the face, that would be a damage, you know. But setting up a policy in which that abuse could happen somehow diffuses it enough so that you can't seek a remedy?
Well, there's really no logical explanation for it, honestly. I mean, a policy to violate the rights of hundreds of men is, I think most of us would agree, worse, more important to deter, more important to make sure it doesn't happen again than a one-off act of violence. The fact that so many men were injured in this way, in my mind, means that it was all the more important that officials should be held accountable. If we don't have accountability, if the victims of civil rights violations can't sue the people that made those violations happen, then there's nothing to stop it from happening again. which is especially worrisome in this day and age under this administration.
Absolutely. Well, let me just ask you, what is the significance of the Inspector General reports from 2003? They documented the abuse, but they also seem to show the policy itself being unconstitutional.
That's right. So the Inspector General investigated what happened with the 9/11 detentions for years after the events and published two scathing reports about the conditions of confinement in which these men were held, the lack of any real evidence at all connecting them to terrorism, and some of the individual abuses that occurred. And the Supreme Court seems to have accepted that this is what happened, that there were serious rights violations that occurred. The court simply, or a majority of the court, doesn't seem to feel as though it's their responsibility anymore to make sure that the Constitution is enforced. They've basically said that if Congress believes that individuals whose rights are violated pursuant to this kind of policy should be able to sue for damages, then Congress needs to pass a law to allow that to happen. Obviously, nobody is holding their breath.
What we want, of course, as you've said, is to prevent this from happening again. Are there other points of intervention to get to that end?
Well, one interesting claim in the case that is not completely foreclosed for future litigants is this 1985 conspiracy claim. So Section 1985, the federal statute that was passed as part of the Civil Rights Act back after the Civil War, and it allows an individual to sue over a conspiracy to deny equal protection under the law. The Supreme Court dismissed that claim in the case as well, but it did it on qualified immunity. It basically just ruled that it wasn't clear that 1985 would apply to these types of claims. It doesn't mean that future litigants can't bring these types of claims in courts. And, you know, I think that that's an avenue that we may need to look to in the future to figure out some way to hold officials accountable when they conspire with other officials or with private parties to discriminate based on religion or race.
Well, when we talked last in September of 2015, you said how remarkable it was that what was then Turkman v. Ashcroft had gone as far as it did. And you didn't think a civil rights plaintiff had ever gotten discovery against cabinet level officials. And without that, of course, you won't have the information to prove that person's involvement and to trace the connection all the way to the top, which is, of course, what was so special about this case. So, of course, it's disappointing today, but what do you take that's hopeful from this many years long fight that you've been in?
Well, I think the fact that the case has just gone on this long, that it has been hanging over these former Bush administration officials' heads for so long, that there are individuals courageous enough to stand up in court and seek justice for these types of violations, knowing that it may take decades on end and they may lose at the end of the day. Yeah, I take a lot of inspiration from that, and I know that will continue. We will all work together to continue to find a way, to try to find a way, to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again.
Well, and then finally, when we spoke also before, we talked about understanding that rulings take place in a social context. And we know that, you know, if in the wake of a terrible crime committed by a tall person, the state set a policy of rounding up and treating as suspects all tall people, that, you know, making the case that that was unreasonable would be a whole different story. It seems that beyond the court and beyond the law, we have some questions to answer as a society about what we really mean by human rights.
Well, that's right. And I think really that raises the question of who bears the burden of these kind of techniques and policies. It seems to me incredibly relevant that the communities likely to be subjected to sort of discriminatory and arbitrary national security policies are Black and brown communities. Communities that the conservatives on the Supreme Court may not have that much empathy for when push comes to shove. That it seems that the rights of those individuals maybe don't weigh quite as heavily as the rights of others. And that's something we have to confront.
We've been speaking with Rachel Mirapol, Senior Staff Attorney and Associate Director of Legal Training and Education at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can find their work online at ccrjustice.org. Rachel Mirapol, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Enough with the stranded polar bears. A recent letter writer to the Boston Globe took issue with the use of the iconic image of a polar bear stranded on floating ice to accompany a story on climate change. Besides being lazy, said Frederick Hewitt of Cambridge, the image just sends an inaccurate message about climate disruption, which is happening everywhere, not just in the faraway Arctic, and the effects of which take myriad forms. Getting reporters to pay attention to all of the stories of climate change is an urgent and ongoing effort. Our next guest is a contributor to that work. Dan Zukowski is an environmental writer. His work appears in Enviro News as well as other outlets. He joins us now by phone from Maine. Welcome to Counterspin, Dan Zukowski.
Thank you, Jeanine. I'm happy to be here.
Well, for a recent article, you pulled together a number of studies that had to do with species response to climate disruption. And polar bears are in there, but it's about a great deal else as well. I guess I would ask you to start with this work out of the Florida Museum of Natural History at the University of Florida about songbirds. What are they finding there?
Yeah, that was a really interesting study. They looked at 48 species of songbirds, and these are birds that migrate primarily from Central and South America up to places in North America, in the U.S. and Canada, for their summer migration, spring and summer. And because of the changes in climate patterns, and those changes are somewhat different in different parts of North America, they can be different from the west to the east, it's kind of throwing these birds off as to when they should leave their winter homes in Central and South America and when they should arrive here in their summer homes in North America. They found, for example, that in Vermont, winter has been shortening by 4 days per decade for the last several decades. So the trees are blooming and the grass is coming out, and maybe the birds aren't even here yet. So there's an issue if these birds arrive too early. It will be cold, and they may not be able to find a place to nest. They may not find a mate because their mate hasn't arrived yet. On the other hand, if they arrive too late, it's the opposite. All the best nesting places may be taken. All the best mates may be taken, and those sorts of things. So there's a real impact. And it's kind of funny because one of the researchers there in that article said you would think that birds who know how to migrate over thousands of miles would be easiest to adapt.
Right.
But they have hundreds of thousands of generations of cues, such as the length of daylight, that haven't changed, okay? And they use those things to determine when to leave and when to arrive. And when they get to their summer homes, things are not what they expect. These birds may adapt over years and generations going forward as the, for example, the earlier birds will survive better than the birds who arrive later. But that's sort of the workings of evolution that happen much more slowly.
Right. Well, the work on birds is just a piece of this article because it's about various species' response to climate destabilization. And folks might think it's interesting that it includes trees, but trees are moving, if you will, too. And that also has implications. What's the research saying there?
Yeah, trees are moving. Of course, it's not an individual tree that gets up and walks, but it's where certain concentrations of trees, they call the center of abundance for a particular tree species, whether it be oaks or certain forms of conifers and so forth. What they're finding is that trees are basically moving north and west. They're moving a bit more in the study that was done to the west, about 50 feet per decade west and about 36 feet per decade north. And these, again, are due to both precipitation changes and temperature changes. Other researchers have also seen trees moving further up mountains. This has been seen in Colorado and California and other places where, as the global temperatures warm, tree species that couldn't survive previously at higher elevations now can. The implications of this is that it changes the entire ecosystem and it changes the food supply for the animals, whether it be birds or other terrestrial animals, that depend on this vegetation to survive. Right. It's funny that you start off with the polar bear issue. Well, the polar bears, of course, have no place further to go. They, there is no more north for them. But another piece I'm working on now is looking at how grizzly bears are now being seen in polar bear habitat, where they've either never been seen before or have only been seen very rarely. I've been to the Canadian tundra. It's a very inhospitable place. There's not a lot growing there. And polar bears don't care because they're not eating vegetation. They're just waiting to get out and hunt for seals. But grizzly bears, as the vegetation changes and it becomes more something that they can actually eat, well, it's going to draw them further north. So we're seeing some conflicts. We're even seeing some interbreeding among grizzly bears and polar bears. When you change one thing in the ecosystem, lots of things ripple out from there.
Absolutely. Well, I can hear some folks thinking, well, so the world is changing, you know, there'll be different birds in different places and different trees in different places. And of course, in your work, you point out, well, yeah, and also, you know, mosquitoes being a threat in places where they weren't before. And obviously, the implications are really almost dizzying, you know, but it's not just, it seems silly to say it's not just a nature story. Nature is everything. But I mean, for reporters who are looking to bring it home, of course, these changes are going to have implications for our lives and what we eat and our jobs as well. So I just ask you to kind of tell folks, you're up in Maine, what have you learned lately about the impacts on the industry in terms of the seafood industry of climate disruption?
Well, all throughout the what is called the Northeast Shelf, off of the northeast part of our continent, so off of New England basically, where there's tremendous amount of commercial fishing. New Bedford, Massachusetts is the most valuable fishing port in the U.S. Fish species have been moving to colder waters and deeper waters because the Gulf of Maine has warmed faster than 99% of the global ocean in the past 10 years. That's a huge change. So where the lobster industry used to be all throughout New England, down into Connecticut, Rhode Island, Long Island Sound, that southern New England portion of the lobster fishery is now gone. It's no longer commercially viable. All those lobsters have migrated north. So Maine had a record catch of lobster last year. But in the future, that could move further north from there. So it is impacting clearly. There's 124,000 jobs in fishing, just in Americans doing commercial fishing from Maine down to Virginia, the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic regions. That's responsible for $10 billion in economic activity. And as all of these species are moving in different directions, it changes what those fishermen can catch, how much it costs, because if they're moving further out or moving into deeper waters, it could cost more just to go out and get those fish. But all these changes do affect jobs and affect people. When we report climate change issues for the public, it's hard for people to perhaps grasp. And I've literally had people tell me that when they keep reading these headlines about polar bears and climate and all those things, they overwhelmed with bad news, and they just want to throw up their hands. Mm-hmm. But I think if we understand how these things relate to us individually, the fact that there's an explosion of Lyme disease because ticks now are, they're in 41 states. They're just really become an issue because of shorter winters, longer warm seasons that are favorable to the deer ticks and blackleg ticks. So we're personally feeling this, but we don't often hear those stories.
Well, I wanted actually to draw you out on that because when I looked for write-ups of the research that you wrote about, I found vanishingly little, although there was some, mostly columns. But I did find stories about people doing things, you know, scientists in Minnesota who are looking for a kind of pine tree that could survive the shifts that are coming to the region. You know, the reason we want to direct media coverage to these issues is not to make people throw up their hands, of course. It's to drive action, not inaction. And so I would add to the positive note, although it is a depressing story, I did find people sort of not waiting for a green light from the government, for example, you know, but getting themselves involved in things like research on trees. And I know that you found, in fact, the songbird work even had a lot to do with citizen volunteer research.
Absolutely. There is a website that anyone can go to called eBird that citizens can enter the birds they see in their backyard or when they go out on a hike, or if you're a real birder, then you maybe you're out there all the time. And that information now is so voluminous that it is helping researchers and helping scientists understand where the movement of birds is. And that's a lot of the data that came into play in some of those studies we referred to earlier. But there's a lot of great citizen science projects that are out there that people can get involved in, perhaps with Audubon or with the Sierra Club or with other wildlife organizations. It doesn't have to be about politics. It doesn't have to be about protests and things like that, but it can be just helping to do some of this citizen science work that is really enormously important. You know, climate change represents the first time in human history that we've had, as all of humanity, one problem that we need to face together, because it affects everyone on Earth. So we don't have a precedent for this. We're figuring out as we go along, but there's a lot of good stories out there, and it's both on a global level with the UN and other organizations, but it's also right down on the front lines.
We've been speaking with environmental writer Dan Zukowski. You can find his work in Enviro News and elsewhere, and you can find his work online at dbzphoto.com. Dan Zukowski, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org. And that's also the place to get subscription information for FAIR's newsletter Extra or to sign up for our Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
This is Alex Smith, and I'm telling you, the world media is asleep, drugged into Trump and Trump investigations, lost in meaningless entertainment babble, while endlessly selling you very dangerous products. Here is the real story. Humans have already driven Earth's climate into a new state. The atmosphere has filled with greenhouse gases, acting like a blanket, with heating that can no longer be stopped. The melting poles are just the beginning. If you are a regular Radio EcoShock listener, you probably know that already from the many scientists, hundreds now, that I've interviewed for you. Maybe it's hard to be surprised, but I'm shocked by countless signs that we are already entering the extreme danger zone. Let me give you just one example. Record high temperatures, lasting longer than usual, are slamming the Northern Hemisphere. I've already talked to you about high temperatures in Pakistan and India and Vietnam, but this is a little closer to home for many of you. Yes, it's the start of summer. Summers are hot. But in the 27 years of monitoring climate news that I've done, I've never seen a collection of heat reports as came in this past week. In the United Kingdom, that place surrounded by cooling oceans, temperatures of 91.5 degrees, melted roads there, that's hot for the UK. Health officials warned young kids who have less bodily heat control than adults, and seniors who die in great numbers during extreme heat events. They warned them to take shelter. And then it got hotter. In London, ambulance calls went up 46% as temperatures there reached 35.4 degrees C, or almost 96 degrees. Most people in the UK do not expect such heat and do not have air conditioning. The science blog phys.org writes about the heat wave all over Europe from London to Siberia. There have been heat deaths already in California and New Mexico. You know some flights out of Phoenix, Arizona were canceled because the heat was too hot for some planes to fly. There were three record hot days in Phoenix, reaching 117 degrees Fahrenheit on June 20th, which is over 47 degrees C. The overnight low, and this is key for human survival, was over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or 32 degrees C. That's relentless heat. Blogger Robert Scribler has a great summary under the title, World Climate Stays in Uncharted Territory as May of 2017 Hits Second Hottest on Record. In perfect timing, our Radio EcoShock guest recently, Camilo Mora of the University of Hawaii, with 17 other scientists from several countries, published a new study in the journal Nature Climate Change. The title is Global Risk of Deadly Heat. And Camilo says, I can't understand why people aren't more worried about this. I mean, America's going to turn into abysmal heat. Seth Borenstein, the reliable reporter from Associated Press, gives it this headline, Too Hot to Handle. Study shows Earth's killer heat worsens. The study says 20% of humans already experience 20 days a year of deadly heat. By the end of this century, unless dramatic action intervenes, 3 out of 4 humans will live or die through that kind of heat. It's planetary heating. Let's call it, global warming. I'm calling it. The heat is here. We may have some cooler years, some crazy cold snaps to bring the deniers out of their cozy homes and offices. But from this time on out, we'll get more and more heat waves, lasting longer, with hotter nights, less ice, and less chance to save ourselves from outright climate catastrophe. Did the Russians interfere with the American elections? Our first guest this week will explain how monumental and lethal all human intervention in the climate has been. Clive Hamilton talks about his new book, Defiant Earth. Then we'll go to what you might call a lesser story. The nuclear industry and their captured regulators in America have decided it's not worth a few million dollars to prevent the evacuation and possible permanent evacuation of places like New York, Baltimore, where millions and millions of Americans live. That's a story repeated wherever there is a nuclear power plant near a big population center. And it's not just the known and demonstrated risk in Russia, Japan, of a nuclear reactor meltdown. No, it's the vast collections of nuclear fuel accumulating in poorly protected pools. And this isn't news to terrorists. They already know. They've already been thinking about it. The legendary Frank von Hippel from Princeton tells you the awful truth.
Radio EcoShock.
We've just had major, major heat waves in most parts of the Northern Hemisphere. It's not just the Middle East and Pakistan where you might expect it. It's New York, London, Paris, and Los Angeles sweltering under road-melting temperatures. But that's just the 30-second weather report, isn't it? The rest of the news goes on as though we haven't changed the climate or gone off course. 3 years ago, I talked with Clive Hamilton about his book, Earth Masters, The Humans Who Want to Control the Climate with Geoengineering. Now this leading Australian intellectual is back with even worse news. The future is stranger than anyone thinks. He's captured all that in a new book titled Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. That's your fate in the new time. Dr. Hamilton has lectured at Yale, Oxford, and Cambridge. He's been the executive director of the Australia Institute and longtime professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra, Australia. From Canberra, Clive, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's good to be back, Alex.
What do you make of the extreme weather that has arrived way sooner than many scientists predicted? Are we in a climate shift already?
I think there's no doubt about that. The climate system of the Earth is now starting to function in a different way. As one climate scientist put it, the old rules that govern the Earth's dynamics are now changing, and we're having trouble anticipating what's going to come, but we do know for sure that it's going to get hotter, the climate system is more energetic, and that will bring more extreme events like cyclones, heat waves, droughts, and so on.
In the United States, and to some degree in your own Australia, people trying to survive ungodly heat or flooded out by unheard-of dumps of rain, they still manage to vote for climate deniers. How is that possible?
It's an astonishing insight into the delusory capacities of the human psyche. After all, the best scientists in the world have been warning us for some 25 years now that we're headed into dark times, hot times, and yet somehow most people find a way to, if not outright deny what the climate scientists are saying, to nevertheless downplay it, avoid it, evade it, put it in another box, pretend that, well, maybe they're exaggerating, or some technology will come along, and after all, aren't there other scientists saying that it's all exaggerated? So we grasp at straws, don't we? And, you know, we need to be, in a way, I've become kind of more forgiving because, you know, well-meaning, reasonably well-informed people I know, yes, they accept the science. Yes, they think we need to do something about climate change, but really it's way down their list of priorities. But if you listen to what the scientists are telling us, what could be a higher priority than protecting the livability of planet Earth?
I have to admit, I had a hard time reading your book, Defiant Earth. And, you know, I mean, there's no throwaway pages here. There's no throwaway sentences. It's really packed. And some sentence would send me past, oh, God, that's true, into a temporary brain melt. I have to go away and think about it. It's just not easy to understand where we are, is it?
I wrote this book because climate scientists, or rather Earth system scientists, there's quite a lot of overlap there, but Earth system scientists are telling us something kind of bigger and more confronting than the science of climate change. They've recently started to tell us that the Earth system, that is the totality of the Earth from its core out through the atmosphere to the moon, has entered into a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, the age of humans. So just stop and think about that. What they're saying is that human impact on nature has now become so large and powerful that we rival the great forces of nature on the functioning of the Earth system as a whole. Wow, we have become a geological force, and that to a significant degree, the future evolution of the planet, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of years here, is now in our hands. We've knocked it off its course and there's no going back. But in the next decades, we will decide collectively, or at least the powers that be will decide, under the influence in democratic countries of the citizenry, whether we knock it much further off course and send the Earth spinning into an extremely chaotic, dangerous, and potentially existential phase of its development. So we have now entered into deep time. That is, the 4.5 billion year history of the Earth is divided up into a whole range of epochs and eras and ages and so on, the Jurassic, the Cretaceous, and so on. What the scientists are now telling us is that we have entered into a new epoch, the Anthropocene, determined by human impact. And this has happened only in the last decades. This is a very, very profound thing that's very hard to get your head around. In fact, I think it will take us years to really understand what the meaning of this new epoch is.
Yeah, I read you saying that the whole 9 billion years time that this planet is expected to live has been split into halves, before humans and after humans, and I had an internal objection. I mean, it makes us sound like the new gods on the block. Isn't that overreaching a bit?
Well, what do gods do? Among many other things, and we're kind of speaking literally if that's your way of thinking, or metaphorically if you're not religiously inclined. I mean, powerful gods determine the future of the Earth, the shape of the Earth, how it changes, how it evolves. And what the Earth system scientists are telling us is that's what we're now doing. So it seems to me that we really have to face up to this kind of astonishing fact much as we may hate it and find it difficult to swallow, the truth is that humans have become powerful beyond any previous imagining. We are now powerful enough to change the geological future of the Earth. So the question that screams out at us is this: how can we own up to the truth of this extraordinary power and take ownership of it without succumbing to the narcissism and the Promethean delusions of grandeur that got us into this impossible situation in the first place? To me, this is the fundamental question. How do we own up to the truth of what the Earth system scientists are telling us about our astonishing technological power, and yet not continue to abuse it and send the Earth off into such a disastrous place that many forms of life can't survive?
Well, I guess the good news and the bad news is we may have delayed the next ice age.
This is one of those facts that I like to use because it illustrates this point so powerfully. Geologists can now predict with a pretty good degree of accuracy when the next ice age will come. And ice ages are determined, and indeed warming periods, by how much solar radiation reaches the Earth. And the Earth has a number of cycles. It wobbles around its axis. The axis changes its tilt. You know, we're talking over periods of thousands of years. And the orbit of the Earth around the Sun varies from pretty much circular to somewhat elliptical. And all of these affect the amount of solar radiation heating the planet. And on this basis, they can calculate that the next ice age is due in around about 50,000 years' time. But the confronting fact is that they're also telling us that because of warming that human beings have brought about on the Earth, much of which is now locked in, and more warming which will inevitably occur, will definitely go beyond 2 degrees, probably 3 to 4. That amount of warming, which will last such a long time, will actually suppress the next ice age in 50,000 years' time. And if we don't do a lot more in the next 2-3 decades, it may well suppress the subsequent ice age, which is due in 130,000 years' time. So these facts tell us just how enduring the human impact on the planet is. And, you know, some people might say, well, hey, who wants another ice age? I don't like the sound of that. Well, I say, rather than warm the planet in an intolerable way for 50,000 years, how about you come back in to me in 49,000 years' time and say, hey, we're expecting an ice age in about, you know, several centuries. Let's start thinking about what we might do.
Good plan. You know, I've got a bit of confusion. What is the difference between the Great Acceleration and the Anthropocene, or is there a difference?
Yes, there is. The Great Acceleration is the term used by Earth system scientists like Will Steffen and Jan Zalasiewicz to describe the really extraordinary takeoff after the end of the Second World War. So from kind of the late 40s, early 1950s, in global resource use, population growth, waste generation, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, resource use, land use, fossil fuel consumption, mineral use, and so on. If you look at a whole range of those over a long period of time, you see that after the end of the Second World War, they suddenly took off and accelerated. And so they call that the Great Acceleration. And they've decided, the Earth system scientists, now, you know, many of the leading ones now meeting in what's known as the Anthropocene Working Group, which is the official body tasked with gathering the evidence to make the case for a new geological epoch called the Anthropocene. Those scientists say, in our best judgment, the new epoch, the Anthropocene, started after the Second World War as a result of the Great Acceleration.
And you write, they prognosticate about a future from which the dominant facts have been expunged, futurologists trapped in an obsolete past. It is the great silence. Who are you talking about?
Well, if you walk into a bookshop, a good bookshop, you'll go to sections which are about the future of the world, our futurologists, our kind of great thinkers who are prognosticating about what the 21st century will look like. one name that comes to mind, Steven Pinker, for instance, but there are plenty of others. You can see them all over the place. And if you open them up and look at the table of contents or go to the index, you'll find no mention or virtually no mention of climate change whatever. And so it's as if they live in another world, one where the science of climate change, let alone the Anthropocene, doesn't exist. It's as though, well, you know, we'll leave the science to the scientists, but, you know, it's not really within our intellectual universe. So we'll talk about, you know, the clash of civilizations and future technological singularities and this kind of thing, as if the scientists don't exist. I mean, these are, you know, the greatest intellectuals in the world, and yet they are in denial. I just find this astonishing. I think our intellectuals are really failing us very badly indeed, because if the great and good at Harvard and Princeton and Cambridge are not deeply engaged with climate change and the kind of earth, the kind of world, the kind of international community that is likely to create, then they don't understand what the future is.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My guest is the well-known Australian academic, Dr. Clive Hamilton. Clive wrote or co-authored books like Growth Fetish, Affluenza, and Requiem for a Species. We're talking about his latest, Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. Now, your previous book, Earth Masters, exposed the dubious ideas behind trying to fix the damage from technology with more technology. But I gather the whole concept of geoengineering is getting outmoded, being based on some sort of classical Earth and not the new Earth systems we've created. Is that what you're saying?
In my earlier book, Earth Masters, I made the point that under the impact of human-induced climate change, the Earth system is moving into a new phase, as some of the Earth system scientists have described it. We are entering into a no-analog state. In other words, nothing like this has happened before. The Earth is becoming, the climate system is becoming more energetic, as they put it, more energy in the system. And that means that it's becoming more chaotic in its behavior, more unpredictable, and of course more uncontrollable. And climate scientists and Earth system scientists use metaphors to try to communicate to us what this means. James Lovelock, for example, famously talks about the revenge of Gaia, and we have Earth system scientists talking about the waking giant and Arctic death spirals to try to communicate to us that the Earth is no longer the passive, submissive entity that we thought it was, whether we were either on the Promethean side, well, there it is, we'll go and exploit it and rip what we want out of it, and we'll, that's what our right, and, you know, who's going to object, or even the environmentalists, you know, my tribe, if you like, who have traditionally regarded the Earth as kind of Mother Earth, passive, submissive, whom we're raping and pillaging. No, Earth is no longer like that. That was the Earth perhaps in the Holocene before we entered into the Anthropocene. But in the Anthropocene, the Earth is an angry beast. And to the idea that we should use our technology, having poked and prodded and provoked this beast into waking up, which is now raging around, that we can now use our technology to try to pacify it, to drug it, to quiet it down, I think is an extremely dangerous approach. And we have enormous power, and we can't repudiate that. What we have to do is to learn to use it meekly, if you like, humbly, responsibly, without running away from it.
And I also have the concern that planners, including some top scientists and almost every politician, assume that our economy will continue despite hit after hit from a destabilized atmosphere, the rising seas and all that. It's like the Stern Report. Here's a 5% cost for addressing climate change or something. What do you think? Can we just keep the economy rolling along despite all this that's happening?
Well, there are kind of two possibly contradictory answers here. One is, the economists have argued that the sensible ones, not the apologists for the fossil fuel industries, that The technologies to replace fossil fuel-based energy are there, available, and not only will they be cheaper, in many places they already are. Here in Australia, for example, it's universally agreed, except perhaps by the coal industry, and even they now have trouble defending their view. It's universally agreed that building solar plants and wind farms will generate cheaper electricity than building new coal-fired power plants. On the other hand, when we look at how the Earth is starting to change in response to warming, and bear in mind the Earth is on average warmer by 1.1 degree, although much more in the Arctic, and I'm completely freaked out about what's happening in the Arctic, and we will definitely warm by twice as much as 1.1 degrees. Look how much trouble we're in now, how much more we're going to get. So how can an economy, the current system, given that it's produced this unfolding disaster, how can it survive? How can it cope? There are people out there, environmentalists, conservative environmentalists, who call themselves eco-modernists, and they're particularly gathered around a think tank known as the Breakthrough Institute in San Francisco. They argue that there's no problem with the system. Our technology-based, profit-oriented capitalist system may have produced a bit of a problem, but hey, it's endlessly inventive, creative, and can tackle any problem, and it will tackle this. So what we need is more technology, more capitalism. And I think this is an extremely dangerous argument. And perhaps there are some people in some countries starting to wake up to this. I mean, look at the kind of support that Bernie Sanders got, who declared himself to be a socialist in the United States. And then Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, who adopted a very progressive social democratic agenda. And so now we have a kind of, we're on the cusp of the turning of the neoliberal revolution, which ought to empower brave politicians to challenge some of the fundamentals of the neoliberal capitalist order.
So how are climate politics going in Australia these days?
Oh, Alex, do you want the long and depressing answer or the short and depressing answer? We now have a prime minister who of our Conservative Party, which oddly is known as the Liberal Party, Malcolm Turnbull, who once said that I will never lead a Liberal Party that doesn't share the same commitment to climate change as I do. And he was seen as the kind of great white hope of conservative politics among those who take climate science seriously. But when he was elevated to the prime ministership, replacing an out-and-out climate science denier in the form of Tony Abbott, suddenly Turnbull found that the forces of darkness, of denial of the fossil fuel industry, the fearful men and women who can't tolerate change, who loathe environmentalism, they got their claws into him. And we saw this man, Malcolm Turnbull, so committed to doing something on climate change, become gradually hollowed out, become the captive of the troglodytes, so that a few months ago he started to argue what we need in Australia is a new generation of coal-fired power plants.
Oh, that sounds so familiar. You know, we'll bring back those coal mining jobs, as Trump says. You know, I was kind of caught in that regard by your later quote in the book from Napoleon saying, politics is fate. What does that mean?
Well, I love this quote. You can read a lot of meanings into it. The kind of meaning I was putting into it in the book is this idea that although there's something happening in the Anthropocene at the grand level of humankind and the Earth, of deep history and dramatic change, if we're going to think about what to do, the answer is always political. The only answer is politics, and our fate, therefore, and indeed the fate of the Earth, lies in the hands of political action. And while we're on the question of fate, which I put into the subtitle of the book, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene, I was very struck by a sentence in a scientific article a number of Earth system scientists who are talking about the impact of humankind on the geological evolution of the Earth and, of course, the way in which the changing functioning of the Earth system under the impacts of climate change, but also other system-wide environmental change. They said of humans and of the Earth, the fate of one determines the fate of the other. And I thought, wow, I mean, that is just so powerful if you start thinking about it over this kind of stretch of big time and big history. But in the end, whatever change comes about as a result of human life on Earth, it will come about not through individual action, not by, you know, conscious consumerism, not by sitting back and hoping that some brilliant mind will invent a new technology that will come along and save us. It will be through politics that the Earth will evolve.
I'm personally not so sure about that. I think that some individual actions and societies changing away almost from the political system, unseen perhaps, you know, as more people grow their own food, go local, do all these small-scale changes that aren't as visible on the federal level. But you also say, and you talked about this earlier, that our choices are either to go for more control, call it geoengineering or climate engineering or whatever, or, and this is a tough one, to practice meekness. I'm wondering if practice meekness might need to be your next book. What does it mean?
Well, let me point out one thing it doesn't mean. It does not mean that we can kind of withdraw from the world, repudiate technology, and, you know, in the old enviro phrase, walk more lightly on the earth. I mean, I think, of course, we do have to walk more lightly on the earth. But the fundamental point about the Anthropocene is that we can't walk away from it. We have shifted the functioning of the earth system in a way that is now irreversible. Because the Earth has now, the rules have changed. We have changed the rules of the way the Earth functions in ways that some ways we do understand. It's getting hotter. We're going to have more extreme weather events, but also in ways that are very hard to predict. So we can't turn back the geological clock from the Anthropocene, which we've now entered, into the previous kind of golden era of the Holocene, where for 10,000 years, the Earth went into this extraordinarily and unusual period of stability and clemency of the weather, so stable and clement that it allowed civilization to develop. Now we've changed all of that, and we can't just say, oops, stop, 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 we'll go back to the Holocene, because we've set the Earth on a different path. What we have to now do is to manage that, to cope with it, to deal with it. I hope that we do it, that we approach that task with an attitude of meekness, of humility, but not without repudiating the incredible power that we have. You see what I mean? How do we take responsibility for this power? Do we do it with great humility and care, or do we do it with a kind of Promethean aggression, a kind of Donald Trump, you know, we can crash through and use our power to subdue the earth? If we try that, we are screwed, and many life forms are screwed. So that's what I'm saying. We have to try this seemingly impossible task of owning up to our power, not running away from it, but using it in a way that minimizes the damage and adapts in a way over the next centuries in a way that is as just and fair and reasonable and respectful of life as we possibly can.
As we wrap up here, Clive Hamilton, is there anything else you would like to talk about with our listeners?
Let me just say one thing, Alex. It's been a kind of fascinating project writing this book, and I've kept just kind of shifting my views of I've understood more, maybe understood less, some readers might think. But some readers, I'm not a Christian or a person with any particular religious orientation, but I know that one or two people who are theologians who read the book in draft saw in it some very powerful theological themes. And I can see what they mean, because it really is about the place of humans on this earth. It is about human fate and how the gods, if I can put it that way, might be looking down on this powerful, errant, but special creature on the earth and our mistakes and how they should regard us, whether we deserve saving, whether there is some kind of hope that we can invest some faith in. These kinds of questions come up right through the book so that people who do have a theological orientation found themselves stopping and thinking about it in the way they think about human beings and our existence on earth. So I found that extremely interesting. So it definitely has a kind of theological resonance for people who are attuned that way.
Well, Clive, I have to admit, I haven't quite finished your book, and it's your fault because you keep sending me away to think. You know, I hope it turns out well.
Thanks, Alex.
I'll put links to today's discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org and also my previous interview with Clive in May 2013. By all means, get Clive's tweets at Clive C. Hamilton and visit his website at clivehamilton.com. His latest brain-bending book is Defiant Earth, The Fate of Humans in the Anthropocene. Clive, thank you so much for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. I always enjoy talking with you.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Americans are not protected from a catastrophic nuclear waste fire at many reactor sites. The fallout from radioactive fuel could be huge, much larger than from the 2011 Fukushima reactor accident in Japan. Millions of people would be exposed to radioactive particles. There could be forced mass and possibly permanent evacuations of major U.S. cities. Taxpayers could be forced to pay trillions for damages and decontamination efforts. That's all in a new article published in the May 26th issue of Science magazine. The report comes from researchers at Princeton University and the Union of Concerned Scientists. Our guest, Frank von Hippel, is a co-author of this warning. He's a senior research physicist at Princeton's Program on Science and Global Security. That is based at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Dr. von Hippel is the author of several books. He has advised governments in the past. He has a thorough background in the physics of atomic affairs. Dr. von Hippel, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Was there a fire in the fuel pools during the 2011 nuclear accident at Fukushima, Japan?
There was not. The water level fell in the pool of unit number 4, but it didn't uncover the spent fuel, and therefore we didn't have the scenario in which the radioactive heat in the fuel would have heated it up to a temperature where the metal cladding, the zirconium cladding on the fuel, would have caught fire.
It was so hard to get reliable information about what happened at Fukushima, especially at Reactor 4, where the building was unstable, and Reactor 3, which was burning and storing plutonium-laced fuel. I guess the Japanese government was trying to control public fear, and U.S. regulators weren't saying much either. Frank, I'm concerned if an accident happens in the States, the public won't get good and timely information for the same reasons. What do you think?
Well, actually, in the case of the Fukushima, U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission was convinced that there was a fire going in pool number 4 for about a week or two after the earthquake, and so their information wasn't very good either. I think they don't cover up. I mean, in Japan, there is a history of cover-ups, but not so much in the U.S. The problem really is the confusion. I go back far enough. I remember Three Mile Island when there was a huge fear that there was going to be an explosion in the reactor. It turned out to be an unfounded fear. But there is a lot of confusion at a time of a nuclear accident.
Well, that's partly because you can't really get to the site. It's too dangerous to go there, and so you can fly over maybe, and even that's dangerous.
That's right. In fact, the hint that we got that maybe there was water in pool number 4 after all was a reflection that somebody in a helicopter thought they they saw through a hole in the, that had been blown in the building by a hydrogen explosion.
Now, following the Fukushima accident and particularly the problems with spent fuel, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission promised to take action to avoid similar risks in America. What action has been taken that you know of?
Well, there was a whole list of possible actions that they considered, and some they took, like having available emergency equipment, pumping equipment, in case the power went out on the regular equipment in the reactor, as it did in Fukushima. But the action that they considered but decided not to take, and we were complaining about in our article, was to end the dense pack, what we call the dense packing of fuel in U.S. reactor pools.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that in a minute, but first I want to point out that the public thinks this is all taken care of, just like people in Japan thought their experts were completely in control of nuclear technology. You know, American authorities and nuclear operators have known about this big risk from nuclear fuel pools for decades. Frank, why are you raising it again now?
Well, it's because, it's a good question why now, because, you know, the politics right now in the United States aren't very favorable to new regulatory initiatives. You know, there's an administration in that wants to reduce the amount of regulation. And in fact, just today they had hearings on nominations for 3 out of the 5 members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And they're all of skeptics of concerning regulations. They want to have a light touch. And so our proposal, which would cost $50 million per reactor, you know, is something that the industry doesn't like, and the industry has a lot of sway over the regulators in the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission right now.
Well, I have to tell you, in previous interviews, experts from the Union of Concerned Scientists told me the NRC has a long history of waiting years to make safety regulations, and then they give nuclear reactor operators a lot more years to implement those changes. So I'm not surprised by what you're saying, but I want to get specific about what this $50 million a reactor could avoid. In the article in Science magazine, there's a graphic map showing possible areas covered by the radioactive plume if a spent fuel fire happened at the Peach Bottom nuclear power plant. That's in Pennsylvania. If the fire happens in January, it looks like Philadelphia becomes red hot and New York City gets a dose that could be survivable. The same accident in April is a massive disaster, spreading hot contamination up and down the East Coast. But a fall fire takes the danger west towards Virginia, Kentucky, and even Ohio. Frank, why such a big difference in the seasons of when an accident happens?
I'm not sure it's the seasons. What we did was we did 12 calculations for a release starting on the first day of each month. And so there is a lot of variation in weather, wind direction, and so on. And it's not necessarily a question of season. It can depend on whether there's rain or not, bringing down the radioactivity that's in the atmosphere. That area of contamination to the northeast of the Fukushima plant was brought down by rain, actually.
Well, I've heard that the Japanese just got lucky and that the prevailing winds took the radioactivity, about 9/10 of it, right out into the Pacific instead of right over Japan.
That's right. It's on the East Coast, and the prevailing winds are offshore.
Well, it's like a nuclear casino there. Now, is there a chance that a major city like New York, Baltimore, or even Washington, D.C., would have to be evacuated entirely if there was a spent fuel fire at just one reactor somewhere in the east?
There is a chance, and we calculated that, after correcting some NRC calculations, that on average 8 million people would have to be relocated. It could go up. It could be much higher than that. That's just an average number. And what we're concerned is not the radiation levels killing people outright, but increasing their risk of cancer to an unacceptable level. And the EPA has set a threshold for the annual dose that in their view would justify relocation, and that our maps are based on that dose.
Would some areas or possibly even a city have to remain abandoned, like the land around Chernobyl, or could the radioactivity eventually be cleaned up, as they're trying to do in Fukushima City?
Yeah, the luck with cleaning up hasn't been so great. You know, in Fukushima, the best they've been able to do is to reduce the radiation level by a factor of 3. So So in areas marginally contaminated, you could do that. I think, of course, you'd put a much, I mean, Fukushima, the contamination is mostly, we're not talking about big cities. We're talking about towns and really a lot of open land. And so there would be a much more major effort, intense effort, if, for example, we're talking about a city like Washington or New York. But I think some painful decisions would have to be made, about whether maybe rather than abandon all that high cost buildings, whether people would decide that they would be willing to tolerate a somewhat higher cancer risk.
More people would die sooner is what it boils down to. I know that California ratepayers had to pay an additional levy to decommission nuclear power plants at the end of their operation period. But who pays for the damages if a nuclear fuel storage facility catches fire?
Well, the industry is required to have a collective insurance pool. And at the moment, that totals $13.6 billion. But if you're talking about $2 trillion, like which is our estimate of the average cost of a spent fuel fire in a dense packed pool, then basically the 99% of the cost would be on the taxpayers. Or on the people, on the people who have to abandon their property.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is physicist Frank von Hippel from Princeton. We're talking about the unimaginable risk if a fire erupts at a nuclear fuel storage facility at any reactor, as detailed in a new article in Science magazine. The Mark I GE design reactors have the dangerous situation of storing some nuclear fuel in the reactor building, essentially above the reactor itself. The four blown reactors in Fukushima all had that design, as you know. Some of the reactors of the same type are still operating in the U.S. I think it's around 20 or so, despite those known flaws. Have the American Mark I reactors been made any safer to avoid the same issues as happened in Japan?
They haven't, really. In Japan, there are other issues besides the elevated spent fuel pool. It turns out that other reactors, even when they have their pools at ground level, many of them can partially drain. There's cavities below them, or maybe a wall is exposed above grade. So, but there are other issues with the GE Mark I, II reactors that you're talking about, and one of them, which we saw in Fukushima, was that the volumes of the containments around the reactors are much smaller than typical for other types of reactors. That issue is an issue that a colleague and I and other people have raised in the 70s after Three Mile Island. And we suggested that if you get into a situation, which actually happened at Fukushima, where that containment gets overpressured, that there be a system where you can release the pressure through a filter system so that the radioactivity is mostly kept inside the building. Most countries, actually, most of Europe, basically Western Europe, adopted that recommendation. The U.S. and Japan didn't. Now Japan is doing that. That's another lesson from Fukushima that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looked at. It estimated it would cost the utilities $15 million, and they decided not to ask them to spend that money.
Now, if the fuel rods that you mentioned are all jammed into pools beyond their original design intention, does that make a nuclear fire more likely or worse if it happens?
It makes not necessarily more likely, but definitely worse. And first of all, there's more fuel to burn, but something else which the NRC has actually found, we hadn't thought of it, was it makes a hydrogen explosion more likely. What happens in the early stages of the uncovery is that steam reacts with a hot metal cladding, and the H2O, the O basically goes in and makes an oxide with the metal cladding, and the H2 then becomes free hydrogen. And in the case of a dense packed pool, the NRC staff found that enough hydrogen would be developed so you would have a explosion that would blow the building open, which is actually what happened at Fukushima, although the hydrogen in that case was from the reactor's cores. And if you have a building blown away, then if there is a fire, all the radioactivity gets released into the open air. Whereas if you don't have a hydrogen explosion, which is what they the NRC staff concluded that you would not have if you followed the recommendation that they rejected. The building would remain intact, and most of the radioactivity would play out on the inside of the building.
Well, I think it's always a good idea to avoid an explosion at a nuclear storage site. I'll go with you that far. Now, there is a safer option, I think, that I've heard about, which is the dry cask storage. Do you think that's safer?
Yes, and in fact, that's what we recommend, and that's what the NRC considered. Basically, after a few years, the NRC was considering 5 years. After 5 years of cooling in water, you can remove the fuel and put it in air-cooled casks. And that was the original plan design of the pools was that they were only going to have fuel in there for a few years and then it was going to be removed. But when what they were going to do with this fuel off-site, that plan was canceled. Then the utilities put more and more fuel into the pools until they're packed about as densely as the reactor cores. That means that they could go critical, and therefore they have to put each fuel assembly inside a box with neutron-absorbing walls. And that's what makes it a dense-packed fuel, if the water level drops and uncovers it, so difficult to cool in one of these accident situations.
How long can those fuel pools be maintained safely if the electric grid goes down for any reason?
Well, it's a slowly developing accident, and what was remarkable about Fukushima was for how long, you know, the situation was out of control. It was for about a month at this site. It takes on that order of length of time for the water to boil down if it's not replenished, for the spent fuel to become uncovered. The other scenario, the NRC thought that was incredible that could happen here, and they didn't even consider such a scenario where things would be out of control for so long. So they considered scenarios where an earthquake would cause the pool to crack and drain, which would be, and they considered scenarios in which within a day or so the fuel would be uncovered.
Hmm. Are the American dry cask designs prepared for a terrorist attack, and are they as good as the German design?
Well, there are a variety of designs, and the German design, I think, that you're thinking about is a very thick-walled cast iron cask, whereas the American design is a thin-walled steel canister and then surrounded by a radiation shield of reinforced concrete. I prefer the German design myself, but I think either is much safer than leaving the fuel in the pool in a dense pack configuration.
So why doesn't the NRC mandate the transfer to dry casks be done right now?
Well, because they calculated it would cost $50 million, and they figured the probability, and so they did a cost-benefit analysis. And the cost-benefit analysis was first to estimate the consequences and then multiply by the probability and then compare that with the cost. And they took an arbitrary probability, which included not taking into account the possibility of a terrorist attack, and they underestimated the consequences. On that basis, they concluded that the benefit in terms of the probability multiplied times the consequences would be less than the $50 million per pool that it would cost the utilities to move early to fuel to earlier than they have to fuel to dry cask storage.
Well, you mentioned terrorism. I know reactor buildings are supposed to be hardened to withstand an attack by crash landing an aircraft. It's my understanding that spent fuel ponds, however, which contain far more radioactive material, are not hardened in that way. True?
The pools themselves are quite robust, but the building above them is a very lightweight building, so that there would certainly be nothing to prevent an aircraft from crashing into a pool.
And is there any possibility the computer systems which operate and monitor those spent fuel tanks could be hacked as cyber warfare or in a terrorist attack?
There could be. It's less of a concern than what the consequences would be for a reactor, because the timescale for a reactor is going without cooling is a matter of minutes before you get into trouble with a meltdown, whereas for a pool, it's really a matter of days. So hacking is less of a concern for the pool.
Okay. Now, if a terrorist attack struck an on-site nuclear fuel, would it be the same thing as a fuel fire for any other reason, like an accident, or might an explosion spread radioactivity further?
I think the concern, fire in a drain pool is sort of like a worst case already.
Mm-hmm.
And so terrorists, the concern about terrorists is that they might be able to cause that, or, you know, the NRC didn't consider that, but they considered the possibility of an earthquake causing that. But it would be a similar event, however it was caused.
Dr. von Hippel, what do you think of the temporary nuclear fuel parking lot proposed for West Texas?
Well, this is a proposal to transport fuel in casks down and basically park them one scenario would be just on a concrete pad in that area. I don't see, for spent fuel at an operating nuclear power plant, I don't see the point, because you can do that equally well at the reactor site. We have an increasing number of reactors which are being shut down, and then after a while, all you have is spent fuel in dry casks, and there is a point to consolidating that in one place so you can have an adequate security.
Who else helped you write this report?
Well, I had a colleague at Union of Concerned Scientists, a physicist who spent his career sort of trying to understand the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and trying to get it to do its job better. And then another colleague at Princeton who had state-of-the-art capabilities of modeling this atmospheric dispersion and deposition, with actually capabilities that the NRC is trying to acquire but has not yet acquired, so that he made it possible for us to have these historical simulations with historical weather, what would have happened had there been a spent fuel fire starting in a particular place on a particular day.
Well, I'm shocked but not surprised that the new administration will appoint people who don't like regulations to the NRC. But if you were called to advise the President or Congress, what priority recommendations would you and your colleagues make?
In this current case, I understand their reluctance to ask the nuclear utilities to make additional expenditures at a time when a number of these nuclear power plants can't compete with wind and natural gas. And therefore, we recommended that actually, if Congress is actually already paying for these dry casks when the spent fuel is transferred, when the pools are absolutely jam-packed and you can't put any more, and you need to put more in because the reactor is discharging it, you take out the oldest 25-year-old spent fuel and put it into dry casks. We're already paying for that, and so I would recommend that we actually pay for doing that earlier and get out of this situation. The other recommendation we make is that in some states, New York, and are actually subsidizing uneconomic nuclear power plants to keep them open. And a minor part of that subsidy would be sufficient to pay for this earlier, what the NRC calls expedited transfer of spent fuel from pools to dry casks. And so the states could require that. They don't have any authority to impose safety regulations on nuclear power plants, but if they're giving money, then that gives them leverage to make a quid pro quo.
Well, as we wrap up, Frank, you are from a famous family of scientists and educators. You've written books for the public about nuclear risks. You were an assistant director for national security in the Clinton White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. You've been at this for at least 5 decades. Does it frustrate you that humans just can't seem to rise up to the responsibility of having and using nuclear technology?
It is frustrating. You know, I've spent most of my time worrying about nuclear weapons, where the risk is even greater. we do make progress now and then, and I, you know, I just hope the question is whether we're making fast enough progress, and we'll only know, you know, with time, whether in fact we've taken actions in time that we really should to make this a safer world.
We'll know if we survive it.
Right.
We've been talking with Dr. Frank von Hippel. He's a nuclear expert, policy advisor, author, and a senior research physicist at Princeton Program on Science and Global Security. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Frank, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The American coal industry is dying, thank goodness, even as coal baron Robert Murray sues TV host John Oliver for telling him so. Trump promises to bring back coal, but he can't. But elsewhere, in Australia, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has reversed himself on global warming and now calls, incredibly, for new coal-burning power plants. I guess he missed the fires and the heat waves and the droughts and the floods. India is counting on coal power for its billion people. China continues to burn mountains of coal every day. Even green-talking Germany continues to burn coal. It's like nobody heard the science, the news, or the weather reports. It's like humans do not believe their own sweating bodies. The atmosphere and the seas are the new invaders. As Clive Hamilton says, this is the dawn of the defiant Earth. Maybe we can't stop this now, but can we at least sound the alarm and head for the lifeboats instead of going down with the ship? That will be my new mission when I return with new Radio EcoShock shows this coming September. In the meantime, I'm going to comb through my 11 years of interviews to bring you the fundamentals and the cutting edges you might have missed. Please tune in again next week. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about the future.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
This week, the Electronic Intifada Palestine podcast begins a four-part interview with Jody Kalia, author of a recently published cookbook, Palestine on a Plate, which in part addresses the issue of how even Palestinian cuisine has not been immune from Israeli plunder.
You know, you open the fridge and you see a memory. You know, it's not just food. You see the table and you see, I do anyway, I see them laughing and I see them chuckling and rolling. I don't see lunch. It's obviously going to feed me, but it has something much deeper to it.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. We are delighted to present this episode with guest host Leila El-Haddad, journalist, documentarian, and co-author of the widely acclaimed cookbook The Gaza Kitchen, A Palestinian Culinary Journey. Leila recently interviewed London-based author Judy Kalla, who wrote the new popular cookbook Palestine on a Plate, Memories of My Mother's Kitchen. Look for an edited version of the following interview, complete with gorgeous photographs of some of Judy Kalla's delicious Palestinian dishes, under Palestinian Cuisine is More Than What's on the Plate on electronicintifada.net. And now here's Leila El-Haddad speaking with Judy Kalla.
This is Leila El-Haddad. I'm co-author of The Gaza Kitchen, A Palestinian Culinary Journey. I'm speaking with Judy Kalla, author of the wonderful Palestine on a Plate, her first book, which was preceded by an app by the same name. Yes. Super excited to be speaking with her today for the Electronic Intifada. And Judy, first I had to ask, Frika cake, I'm intrigued.
What do you want to know? So how did it come about?
Yeah, because I kind of was flipping through the book and, you know, mostly I was like, yeah, that's familiar. Yeah, oh, that's interesting. And of course, you have a lot of sort of modern spins on some of the recipes. Yeah. But that one, I was like, what, Frika?
I just basically wanted to create a cake that had all little elements that I think are very Palestinian, which is the figs and the pistachios and the frike, of course, and lemon and all the other, you know, citrus spices and things. So I, you know, decided that, you know, any sort of flour base would do. So I just whizzed up the frike and turned it into a powder, and it just sort of worked. I think it's sort of quite nutty and has a savory texture, but then with the sweet figs and the salted sort of pistachio, it just all came together by accident, as well as sort of trial and error. And I was really happy with the result. I mean, I made it in loaf tins and they didn't work. They were just too heavy. They kept dipping. So that's why I really specified it has to be in a round tin. Otherwise, you'll be disappointed with a sort of deflated cake. But I just wanted to make something not crazy, but things that elements of Palestine in a cake, I guess.
And I should mention, I actually did make this cake yesterday and it was absolutely delicious, very distinctive flavors. And I was just very lucky that I have a small little fig tree that's very hard to grow here in Maryland, but it is, you know, bearing fruit. So I was able to use some of those and, you know, it was incredible. And I, in retrospect, I was like, well, that makes sense because, you know, basically wheat and well done. That was kind of one of the highlights of the book. I was like, that's really interesting.
Oh, yeah. I'm happy you tried it.
Yeah. And, I did have a personal question of being sort of a specialist, I guess, in the cuisine of the broader Gaza region. I was really curious about the fennel apple and pomegranate salad and the pomelo shrimp salad, because I'm very familiar with the fact that fennel is used in Gaza, but I had never heard of those combinations before, and I didn't know if that was something or where you had come across that. Or
my grandmother basically used to make these dishes for us, not necessarily the pink apple lady that I used the book, but, you know, their own version of whatever apple they had. And I just, the vinegar, the dressing was my own, just a sweeter dressing for that particular salad. But the rumman and the fennel and the dill is very much part of that culture, I guess, in that area. And she it's really stuff from her that she gave my mom, and everyone changes things by the time they come to someone else.
Definitely.
So with more inspiration from her salads and dishes that she cooked. And she was very, very creative. And she had 11 children. My mom's mom. And she cooked a lot and made a lot of different things all the time. They were very demanding. and they loved their stomachs. So this is really where these particular dishes, actually, all the dishes came from her and my teta, and then to my mom and so on. So there's always some trace back,
right?
With a few changes.
Absolutely. So while we are on the topic of family, can you actually tell me a little bit about your family and sort of where they're all from and how they were. Yeah. And so is your mom's mother, was she also from Lid, or?
She was born in Jaffa.
Ah, okay.
And then she married my grandfather. She moved to Lid. And my dad's mom and dad were from Safad, but my dad's dad worked in Nazareth as a policeman. So they sort of have a little bit of everywhere, but they're all, you know, sort of close by to wherever they moved from. And they were there all their grown up life until they had to leave. And they went to Syria. Individually, they didn't know each other. They met while they were traveling there. And they had 20 kids between them. And my grandfather's had passed away young. And my grandmother's sort of built a new life in this building in Damascus with their very young kids. And that's how my parents met, really from almost birth. And then Syria was home for them. And then my parents moved to Qatar and then to London in 1981. So, yeah.
Yes. Well, again, I'm sure very different, but very similar experiences, I would say. I mean, it's sort of the quintessential Palestinian experience, right? Yeah. Being, you know, displaced and then raised in various places. It's very confusing, yeah. I think, to anyone that's not familiar with the Palestinian experience. Because same with me. I was born in Kuwait and raised in Saudi Arabia and then came here when I was, you know, in college and so on. But I wanted to so it's
like, why did they leave?
No, like, no, it makes no sense. So you're Saudi or are you from Kuwait or right? Why did they leave? You know, and that's always kind of held against you. I remember even as a child, you know, if you were the family of refugees, which, you know, we were, my parents actually left in the late 70s to seek employment or work. But my husband that's always held against you. Well, your family shouldn't have left. And if you did leave voluntarily for work, that, you know, so it's always kind of this stigma that you're dealing with.
Catch 22.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, anything. It's frustrating. But
absolutely. But and then again, the bridge to food, or food as bridge, right? Food as lens. It's interesting that you mention and then you note that your love of food or food was sort of always present. And speaking about your grandparents and siblings, I feel like I know them through the book. I had a very different experience in the sense of, I don't know how familiar you are with my work, but I come from the sort of long line of women on my mother's side who were like, you know, all about, you know, women's lib and feminism and women in the workplace. And again, part of it fueled by what happened, by the Nakba and everything that came after that. And this clinging to this, you know, this urgency to find one and keep one's place and survival, basically. And my grandmother was a firm believer that a woman's place, again, was in the workforce, in the workplace, not at home, not domesticity, not in the kitchen. And that carried on. And so I always longed for the kind of things that you describe. I'm like, I wanted to curl up next to my grandmother and have her cook for me. Even though she herself was not Palestinian, she was born and raised in Palestine. She was, her mother was a Kurdish Damaskin, and her father was Cherkasy. But she would recoil in terror if I ever asked her, even though she was an incredible cook, how to make a certain dish, or what do you think? Is that all you think I'm good for cooking? You know, so, and my mother would cook as a matter of duty, right? Like, she was a physician, she worked full time, but she had to have family to feed, and she hated cooking and she found it tedious and it wasn't interesting to her. So I sort of developed my love of, you know, food and again, food as a lens and as a narrative device, and much more than that, right? Sort of as a key to unlocking our identity and our past, maybe because of its absence. So I note the striking difference that I don't know if I would call it more traditional or not, but it was kind of something that was always present. But then at a certain point, you talk about how your curiosity about your Palestinian history and background, or you developed a curiosity about your Palestinian history and background. And, you know, and talking about Palestinian food being an identity. So maybe speak a little bit about those two things.
Yeah, I think, like you said, we had the opposite side. My aunties were all housewives and looking after kids. And my mom also, she was actually studying to be in pharmaceuticals. And my dad and her married very young. And my sister came straight away. Then the next one, next one, next one, next one. When there was five, all of a sudden, and she was 30, like, oh my God. And she didn't have time anymore. But she said, you know, she grew up with us because she was quite young, and really sort of pushed us to do what she didn't end up doing. And she didn't regret it. You know, I even asked her now when we were in Germany together, I said to her, you know, do you regret not working and just being our mum? And she said, no, because everyone is doing so well. And if I wasn't there, who knows what would have happened and where you would have ended up. And not that we would have been failures in life, but everyone's path sort of was almost designed by my mom by default. She's very artistic, and we're all into sort of arts in some kind of way, except for my brother, who was snatched by my dad and sort of dumped in Qatar and just go and work there. But it really was like the home time was so important. After school, we'd all sit together, and if we were not all there, we wouldn't eat. We'd wait until everybody came. And it wasn't about strictness. It was more just family time, because my dad was so busy and my mom missed us. So dinner time was always together and talking about whatever, anything goes. If we're upset, if we're happy, if school and what have you. And we were very lucky because she was very generous with her cooking and always made different things, because my sister Maya doesn't eat chicken, Lara doesn't eat lamb. I eat everything. My brother loves everything. Tanya likes everything with lemon and chili. So there was always something for somebody. And I started to see this as really something special and not ordinary, because I went to my friends' houses and their parents would like dump something on the table and that's dinner and everyone's sort of going for it. And I'm thinking, oh my God, where's the side of this? And what? But almost stupidly thinking we were normal and right. This is abnormal. Right. But actually most people eat like that and not like us. I wanted to get to know more about it, and I wanted to go into cooking. I always was with her, like I said in the book, since I was little. And I didn't know anything really about identity or Palestine or whatever. I knew we were Palestinian, and I knew that my parents were very proud of it. And they told us stories and their parents' stories and their parents' stories. So it was always something nice to talk about. And then when we started to grow up, we saw all the terrible things on the news, and you know, we don't need to like go over them on here, but you know, we all know what happens. And suddenly the image that we had was shattered, and I was like, what the hell is going on? And we started investigating and reading and learning. And I felt when I started to learn how to speak and read and write Arabic properly, I felt more interested and able to understand things better. And I just wanted to go through it with the food, because I felt a lot of things when I ate, not just, oh my God, I'm starving and I want to eat. We didn't eat for fuel. We ate for pleasure. And everything has a memory connected to it, and a feeling and a thought. And I felt I wasn't the only person that felt this way. And obviously my sisters are the same, and I spoke to other people, and this is sort of how this book was not written to be published. It was written for myself, so to speak, and I was just documenting things, and I really felt that we need a voice like you and like Rawia Bishara and like myself and Dima Sharif, lots of people who are really making a positive you know, kind of dent in the food world, and giving an identity to the food. I think what's frustrating about this whole idea is that I was just having an interview with a lovely lady called Vared Gutman from Haaretz newspaper.
Yes, I know her well, yeah. Well, I'll get to that. But,
She asked me, you know, like, do you get upset about all the Israeli restaurants that are opening in London and the Jewish food? And I said, so of course I get upset when matloube is the dish of the day in an Israeli restaurant. Yeah. I'm frustrated because the word is Arabic and it's Palestinian, very traditionally. And sakhan was also the dish of the week in another place. I said to her, it's almost insulting. Of course they can make it and they can cook it and feed it to people and it's no issue. But when it's labeled under a different, it's like we make pasta and pizza and it's Palestinian pasta. It's not. It's almost absurd to do things like this. So I felt while I was writing it to really sort of of course, all the food comes from everywhere, and then it ends up in one specific area, and it becomes their you know, sort of staple. But I felt frustrated and aggravated that people were enjoying msabbaha and saying, "Oh my God, amazing Israeli msabbaha, delicious breakfast." I'm thinking, no, actually, it's not. And this is the book. It's obviously not a political book, but it is by default because of the title. And I really wanted it to have an identity, like you know, the Gaza kitchen and Palestine on a plate. I didn't want it to be, you know, lemons and roses or whatever.
Sure.
I think they're beautiful titles. I just didn't think that it was me and it would lose the whole point of the book. For me, in this instance, maybe if I write another book number 2, 3, 5, they can all have different things. But the identity was to really be captured in this.
Absolutely.
The electronic intifada.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who examines key elements in the Senate healthcare bill and its likely impact on life and death healthcare issues for millions of Americans. Andrea Flynn, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, who looks at provisions in the proposed Republican healthcare legislation that targets Planned Parenthood and erodes women's reproductive rights. And Mike Oxford, with a disability rights organization, ADAPT, who discusses his group's civil disobedience protests targeting the Republican Senate's proposed repeal and replace healthcare legislation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Mexico's top investigative journalists and human rights activists were targeted by advanced spyware sold to the Mexican government by an Israeli software company. The software is designed to combat criminals and terrorists. Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, denied any government role in the attempted hacking of smartphones of top journalists and activists. Among those targeted was journalist Carmen Arestegui, who exposed the scandal that Nieto's wife bought a $7 million home from a government contractor. The prominent human rights center that investigated the disappearance of 43 Mexican students in 2014 was also a target of surveillance attacks. The spyware scandal was revealed in a New York Times investigation. In Mexico, only a judge can authorize surveillance of private citizens, yet Mexican security agencies routinely ignore the requirement for a court order. 9 victims of alleged spyware attacks have filed a criminal complaint with the Mexico Attorney General's office. Mexico is one of the most dangerous nations to be a journalist. So far this year, 6 reporters have been murdered and 25 disappeared. The number of homeless Latinos grew by 63% in Los Angeles last year, driven by a spike in housing prices and a vulnerable immigrant population. Many Latinos who work 2 to 3 low-wage jobs are reluctant to reach out to social service programs for help or apply for public assistance out of fear of being flagged for deportation. Across Los Angeles County, 20% of Latinos live in poverty. African Americans saw a slight increase in the number of homeless, but while they make up 9% of LA County's overall population, they still represent a disproportionate 40% of the county's homeless. According to a study released by the Homeless Services Authority, renters living in Los Angeles are the most cost-burdened nationwide. More than 2 million households in LA and Orange counties have housing costs that exceed 30% of their income. Nearly every demographic, including youth, families, and veterans, showed increases in homelessness, but Latinos delivered one of the sharpest rises, adding more than 7,000 people to the surge. As temperatures hit record highs in the Arizona desert, the U.S. Border Patrol raided a humanitarian aid camp run by the nonprofit group No More Deaths and arrested four people who they accused of illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. 2 days earlier, Border Patrol agents set up roadblocks around the medical aid camp. According to a statement by No More Deaths, agents were on foot, in vehicles, and ATVs surrounded the camp. The heavily militarized presence discouraged immigrants from coming to the aid camp during the record heat wave in the Sonoran Desert. June and July are the deadliest months for migrants crossing the Arizona desert. 61 deaths have been reported in Arizona thus far this year, according to a group that tracks deceased migrants, which recorded 169 deaths in 2016, though some activists suspect the true number is far higher. No More Deaths blamed the hardline immigration stance adopted by the Trump administration for the raid, which it said broke a long-standing agreement that border agents would respect the camp as a medical facility under international Red Cross standards and not interfere with its work. Joanna Williams of the Kino Border Initiative observed, "We're in the middle of an extreme heat wave, up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit in some parts, so the timing of it was very problematic in the sense of we should be dedicating our energy and resources so that people don't die in the desert." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After the Republican-controlled House of Representatives managed to narrowly pass a long-promised bill to repeal and replace Obamacare, the U.S. Senate unveiled their version of the legislation on June 22nd that was written in strict secrecy. Like the House bill, the Senate's Better Care Reconciliation Act would dramatically reduce funding for Medicaid, which will force states to downsize their programs and decrease the number of recipients who will then lose coverage. While the Senate bill would maintain some of Obamacare's subsidies, they will be greatly reduced, particularly for older Americans. Both the House and Senate legislation would repeal the mandate for Americans to buy insurance and most employers to offer it. As a result of the elimination of Obamacare taxes, those in the top 1% who earn $875,000 annually and more would receive average tax savings of $45,500 a year. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office analysis of the Senate bill found that 22 million more people would lose health insurance coverage by 2026, with 15 million losing their coverage in 2018. The CBO also estimated that premiums and out-of-pocket expenses would increase for many low-income people and for people nearing retirement age. After a growing number of Republican senators announced their opposition to the bill, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell postponed a vote on the legislation that he'd scheduled for before the July 4th holiday recess. Your reporter spoke with Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who served as an economic advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. Here, Professor Friedman examines key elements in the Senate bill and its likely impact on life and death health care issues for millions of Americans.
We've seen three bills. The first House bill, which never came to a vote, the second House bill that passed, and now the Senate bill. They've had in common eliminating all the taxes associated with the Affordable Care Act. That is the priority for the Republicans. These are the taxes that are paid by the wealthiest 1% or so of Americans, those earning over $250,000 a year. And a lot of people don't realize that there were taxes associated with the Affordable Care Act because most people don't pay them. And these bills all eliminate these taxes, although there's some variance in whether the tax is eliminated immediately or after a year. And that generates a reduction in revenue for the federal government of about $600 billion over 10 years. Now, under the rules, if you're going to cut taxes by that much, you need to cut spending by that much. And the Republicans are happy to do this because the second thing the bills have in common are cuts to Medicaid And these cuts to Medicaid, which Medicaid covers about 20% of the American public now, and reducing Medicaid is a big deal because most of the spending on Medicaid goes to children, goes to the elderly in nursing homes, and goes to the disabled. So you're cutting Medicaid, you're cutting health care for many of the most needy Americans. Each time they've come at this, each of the three bills, the cuts to Medicaid have grown larger. The current Senate bill cuts Medicaid over 10 years by about $800 billion, basically taking $500, $600 billion out of Medicaid and giving it to the rich. Also, the CBO scoring has a 10-year window. They've backloaded the cuts to Medicaid, so they will be growing even more. They're cutting 20% of Medicaid spending over the next 10 years. It's going to be more than 20% in the 10 years after that. The third element is eliminating or transforming the subsidies provided in the Affordable Care Act for working people to buy health insurance. Poor people were to be put on Medicaid, and in many states like Connecticut and New York, they did the Medicaid expansion, and low-income people are on Medicaid. Above that, above 138% of the poverty line, people who didn't have health insurance were given subsidies under the Affordable Care Act to buy health insurance. The Republicans have transformed those subsidies, and you know, each of the bill is a little bit different. The House bill in this is a little bit worse because it got rid of those subsidies linked to income entirely and instead provides the subsidies linked to age, which means that higher income people at different ages would be getting subsidies. So not only are you cutting taxes on the rich, but you're giving money to rich people and taking it out of working people.
Professor Friedman, I have read some studies that correlate the number of uninsured people in this country with an increase in the rate of deaths that occur when families don't have health insurance. What are the estimates here, given the CBO scores of both the House and Senate bill of 23 and 22 million people without health insurance over the next decade? What are the numbers of people who will likely die because of the lack of health insurance?
Yeah, a rough rule of thumb, and using a conservative projection, is 1,000 people die for every million people without health insurance. If you go on that number, then 2018, when they project 15 million people will not have health insurance, there'd be 15,000 additional deaths, which is more than the peak for the Vietnam War for the United States. By the end of the period, when 22 million people are projected not to have health insurance, there'd be 22,000 deaths. On average, over the 10-year period, there'd be about 18,000 extra deaths, or about almost 200,000 extra deaths in the United States over this 10-year period. That's a conservative number. First, because I think the CBO is downplaying the number of people who will lose health insurance. And second, because it's not taking into account the number of people who will die because they have inadequate health insurance. I mean, a health insurance plan that has a $5,000 deductible and an actuarial value of 54% is not enough insurance for people to actually see the doctor or fill prescriptions. I've estimated, using county data, that there are about 4 people who die because they have inadequate insurance. They're underinsured for every person who dies because they don't have any insurance. If you assume that that will hold here and that the number of people dying because their insurance coverage gets worse under this, you know, the insurance coverage doesn't have the essential benefits they need, etc., then we could be looking at over 10 years as many as 800,000 Americans dying because of inadequate insurance or lack of insurance altogether.
That was Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who served as an economic advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. Find more analysis of the proposed GOP healthcare legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Of all the constituencies that stand to lose if Republican healthcare legislation is signed into law, women, and especially low-income women and women of color, will likely pay the highest price. That's because many of the services that were required to be included under Obamacare would no longer be guaranteed, including access to birth control, pregnancy care, delivery of babies, and newborn care. All basic medical services, which are mandated in every industrialized nation in the world's healthcare systems, except for here in the U.S. Under the proposed GOP repeal and replace legislation, each state could decide whether insurers would be required to cover the services listed in Obamacare's essential health benefits package. Both the House and Senate health care bills defund Planned Parenthood for 1 year, blocking Medicaid reimbursements to Planned Parenthood clinics, which provide women's health care and abortion services. This is a serious blow to women and men as well, who count on access to the affordable, respectful health care that the group provides. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Andrea Flynn, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, a New York-based progressive think tank dedicated to carrying out the legacy of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, specifically addressing the drivers of economic inequality. Here she examines provisions in the Republican health care legislation that targets Planned Parenthood and erodes women's reproductive rights.
What we would see if this bill were to pass would be that each state would be able to make a decision as to whether insurers would have to cover the services in that essential health benefits package. And what we know is that before the Affordable Care Act, a very small percentage of plans on the individual market actually offered maternity care. And there's a real fear that if that coverage were optional for states, that you'd see many states that would stop requiring that coverage and that many women would have a very difficult time finding and affording maternity care.
The bill also includes defunding Planned Parenthood for 1 year. I'm not sure if that was considered a compromise or if the members of Congress who support that just figure it's enough to destroy the organization.
Because they are passing this through budget reconciliation, there are a number of rules that limit, just how far they're able to go attacking specific programs. So this bill does defund Planned Parenthood for 1 year, and there are two things that I think are important to know. One is that when clinics close, as we have seen in Texas over the past few years, it is very, very difficult for them to reopen. They lose their infrastructure. They lose their patient base. It's not like they just close their doors and then in a year or 2 years or 3 years when their funding comes back, they're able to magically reopen. Once the doors are closed, the provider is out of the community and it is very difficult for them to open those doors again. The second thing I would note is that while the health bill only defunds Planned Parenthood for 1 year, the president's budget goes much farther and completely defunds Planned Parenthood from all federal funding sources. So, I think the conservatives that are making the rules right now are trying to make the rules are really attacking reproductive health care from every angle. So even though the health bill only looks at 1 year, I think what we're looking at is a much broader assault on Planned Parenthood and other providers that women rely on in this country.
And Planned Parenthood serves men, too.
Yes, I think, not only women, and I think we talk a lot about low-income women and women of color, then those are critical populations that rely on Planned Parenthood. But we also know that young people and members of the LGBTQ community and also men rely on Planned Parenthood. And that for many of those individuals, there's simply nowhere else to turn, either because there's not another provider in their community or because for a wide range of reasons, they don't trust other providers. And for many people, Planned Parenthood is the only place of trusted care that's available to them.
Andrea Flynn, on June 27th, 2 days before the vote was planned, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell pulled the bill, acknowledging he doesn't have the votes to pass it. He couldn't appease senators on the far right, like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, without alienating the more moderate senators, like Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, and vice versa. What do you think are the bill's chances to pass eventually?
So what we're hearing from Democratic senators is that it's really essential that individuals who are opposed to this bill call their lawmakers, even if they live in a state where they know their senator is going to vote no. But what we're hearing is that there have not been as many calls to oppose the Senate bill as there were to oppose the House bill, and that it is really essential in the next day or two for all of us to be calling to oppose this bill.
This bill was written by 13 white male senators, even though there are Republican women in the Senate who could have been invited to the table. This is so blatant, and it seems that over the past 30 years at least, this scenario would have doomed the bill. But it's unclear how many people are even upset by this in the age of Trump. Could you comment?
Yes, I would love to. It is really, really hard to swallow that a group of 13 white men made these decisions that will have an incredibly disproportionate impact on women, particularly poor women and women of color. And, you know, I think when we look not only at the health bill, but also the budget that was put forth by President Trump, that would also have an incredibly disproportionate impact on the same group of women. It's really hard to think of the last, you know, 5 months of this administration as anything other than an outright attack on women's rights, their ability to access health care, their ability to take care of themselves and their families. It's very, very troubling.
That was Andrea Flynn, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Find more news and analysis on how the GOP's proposed health care legislation erodes women's reproductive rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Senate Republicans unveiled their version of legislation to repeal and replace Obamacare on June 22nd, disability rights activists in wheelchairs and some on ventilators staged what they described as a die-in outside Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office. When 60 protesters from the disability rights group ADAPT blocked access to the GOP leader's office, Capitol Hill police moved in but encountered passive resistance, which led to some activists being subjected to rough treatment. 50 protesters were arrested. The bills proposed by both the House and Senate, with support from President Trump, would cap and cut Medicaid, triggering dramatic reductions in funding that would have severe repercussions for Americans with disabilities. Many people living with disabilities rely on Medicaid for their basic care and survival. Those who could no longer pay for home care would be forced to leave their independent living situations and be institutionalized. In a statement, ADAPT said, "The nature of the Trump Care bill calls for a nonviolent but passionate demonstration, as our lives are at risk. We know with the proposed cuts to Medicaid, people with disabilities will die. This means we will continue to fight for our lives and continue to be arrested as the police deem necessary." Your reporter spoke with Mike Oxford, a national organizer with ADAPT, who was one of those arrested at the Capitol. Here he talks about what's at stake for disabled Americans if the GOP health plan is signed into law, and his group's tactic of employing nonviolent civil disobedience.
When it became clear to our group that Majority Leader McConnell was not just kind of directing traffic and, you know, sort of in a presiding role, but that was in fact very much leading this effort, we decided that he would be a real prominent person that we could draw attention to, you know, what he was doing. So a group of about 61 of us from several states around the country, just people who could get there quickly, you know, got together, and we decided to dramatize the Medicaid cuts by staging a die-in, which meant that people that use mobility devices like wheelchairs or scooters, you know, that could slid out of their chairs and laid on the floor and basically occupied his office. And I think a good part of the hall up and down outside, even though I was inside the office and really couldn't see what was going on a whole lot outside. And we did our usual, we chanted and sang and clapped and so on and wouldn't leave. And ultimately, police were put in a position of having to carry folks out because people weren't going to leave and weren't going to get up off the floor. So they carried people out. 43 of us were arrested, were taken down to the Capitol, and we were detained. We were kept under arrest at the law enforcement center for about 10 hours until everybody got processed out. We feel in a large way, it's very much an assault on people with disabilities. I mean, a lot of the money does support people with disabilities of all ages, you know, older Americans, and it helps people live in the community, you know, have a good life to live, get employed, be involved in the community, and do all these things. And it just seems so short-sighted, since most of the people would be eligible for a more expensive institutional setting. And we just think it's a real short-sighted, mean way to give a great big tax break to rich people.
Mike Oxford, the dramatic cuts being proposed by both the House and Senate in terms of Medicaid and Obamacare system in general is not just a hardship for many people with disabilities. It's potentially a life-changing or even life-ending proposition. Explain to our audience the life and death issues involved here that I think not enough people in the country understand here about what's at stake with how the Senate and House vote on these proposed health care bills.
I'll give a real good example. So one of the things that happens with these Medicaid long-term service programs is it supports people that use ventilators to breathe and pays for assistance, you know, so people can get that care they need at home, so people can work and so on. Without the funding to pay for that, people won't be able to breathe. And so people end up hospitalized or, again, put in some kind of ventilator nursing facility, which many regular nursing facilities don't even take people that use ventilators. And it really is dangerous. And, you know, we're convinced that, you know, people don't live very long unless they're in the community and getting appropriate care for that sort of thing, including with their families involved. So that's kind of one example. Other people that currently get home and community services and supports, I don't think there's any way. I think they'd live on the street, you know, before they would go back to an institutional placement. Again, very dangerous, very life-threatening. You know, people need to get appropriate care so you don't get skin breakdown, you know, pressure ulcers, you take the right meds and so on. And all those sorts of supports would break down, and people will try to get by as best they can, and it's just extremely dangerous when that happens. Part of the reason that ADAPT has employed nonviolent civil disobedience is we think we are in a civil and human rights struggle. Just like the struggles before us that we've learned from, the civil rights struggle in our country of the 40s, 50s, 60s, still going, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, Dr. King. I mean, these are the classic things that we're trying to employ to elevate our issue and our concerns. Secondly, you know, I think it's still true, but certainly years ago, where people with disabilities were generally viewed as not powerful, as, you know, in need of supervision, care, whatever. And we think that by employing our struggle this way, it does show that we are powerful actors and powerful in the world of policy and politics and so on. So we have to exercise power through our people power and by dramatizing the kind of power that we can bring to bear.
That was Mike Oxford, executive director of the Topeka, Kansas Independent Living Resource Center and a national organizer with a disability rights group, ADAPT. Learn more about ADAPT and their campaign opposing adoption of the GOP repeal and replace healthcare plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, WERN in Columbus, Ohio, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Of the Earth, which was known as the Handbook of the Black Revolution, from Accra in Ghana to Oakland in California. This work, as much a psychological study as a diagnosis of the nature of French colonialism in Algeria, gave militants tremendous insights into the nature of imperialism and how resistance exploded against it. Former Black Panther leader Kathleen Neal Cleaver has written that Fanon's influence on black revolutionaries in the U.S. was profound. But before he published The Wretched of the Earth, he wrote a remarkable series of articles anonymously for the Algerian revolutionary journal El Mujahid from September 1957 to January 1960. El Mujahid's attacks on the French political and military colonial officials is unusually sharp and focused, reflecting Fanon's unique psychological and ideological insights into the Algerian and African struggles against imperialism. El Mujahid is an Arabic term meaning one who wages jihad or struggle, and here one sees Fanon in a potent war of words against the foreign occupation of Algeria. But Fanon was far more than a word warrior. In his 1964 work, Toward the African Revolution, we find Fanon, the critic, the political analyst, the Africanist, the internationalist, the Marxist, and the anti-imperialist. In his El Mujahid articles, Fanon anonymously gives voice to the FLN, French Front Libération Nationale, English National Liberation Front, and ridicules French efforts to tie the FLN to raids, killings, and massacres, condemns Arab and African collaborators, and dissects how French forces use torture to intimidate the Algerian resistance. Fanon writes, "Torture in Algeria is not an accident or an error or a fault. Colonialism cannot be understood without the possibility of torturing, of violating, or of massacring." Fanon was a revolutionary journalist, or perhaps more clearly, a revolutionary who also worked as a journalist. His heart was with all anti-imperialist, revolutionary, and national liberation movements. His heart was with rebel friends like Nkrumah of Ghana and Lumumba of Congo. His heart was with what he called the wretched of the earth, the world's dispossessed. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Early 1830s, foresaw the coming of civil war
And this some 30 years before the first blow was struck at Fort Sumter, Charleston, South Carolina, 1861. The parties that exist today are different political animals, but they still stand in contention against each other. Bipartisanship is but a mirage, as each side fights for supremacy and ultimately for power. China's modern founding father, Mao Zedong, once wrote that politics is war without bloodshed. That about sums it up. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
How have press freedoms in Ukraine deteriorated since the Euromaidan of 2013? Who is journalist Igor Guzva, and why is he being targeted by Ukrainian authorities? Has it become a criminal offense to express communist beliefs in Ukraine? What has happened to popular movements against the Ukraine state since the Euromaidan? Have Ukrainian critics abroad been affected by the developments of the last 3 years? On this week's Global Research News Hour, the last of our regular season, we'll be discussing how dissenting voices, particularly journalists, in post-Maidan Ukraine are being targeted by state authorities and the prospects for improvement in the face of Western media silence on the issue. Our guest for the hour is a Ukraine-Canadian scholar who has been to the country twice since the rise of Euromaidan. On this week's program, Press and Political Repression in Post-Maidan Ukraine, a conversation with Halina Mokrushina. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 30th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, Global Research. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. This wasn't the most advanced form of sarin, if there was sarin, but we really don't know. That's not the issue. The issue in my story is not to try and explain what happened, but to explain what did not happen. What did not happen is Syria did not drop a sarin bomb that morning. That was an excerpt from an interview with Seymour Hersh under the headline, Hersh, Trump Ignored Intel Before Bombing Syria, posted June 28th, originally appearing at the Real News Network. U.S. President Donald Trump is playing a game of nuclear chicken with Russian President Vladimir Putin regarding Putin's threat on June 19th to go to war against the United States if the U.S. again shoots down inside Syria in the sovereign territory of the internationally recognized as legal sovereign Syrian government, Syrian aircraft, or the aircraft of any of the foreign governments that have allied with Syria, Russia, Iran, and China. After the U.S. had shot down a Syrian government plane on June 19th, which was bombing jihadists whom the U.S. government backs in order to overthrow the Syrian government, Russia announced, quote, "In areas where Russian aviation is conducting combat missions in the Syrian skies, any flying objects, including jets and unmanned aerial vehicles of the international coalition discovered west of the Euphrates River, will be followed by Russian air and ground defenses as air targets," unquote, meaning ordered out or else immediately shot down. That would place the U.S. and Russia in a traditional war against each other over Syrian territory, Russia to protect Syria's government, U.S. to replace it by a Saudi-allied jihadist one. The loser in that war over the battlefields in Syria would then have only one way to prevent defeat, which is a blitz nuclear attack against the other's homeland, World War III between Russia and U.S., which would be won, quote-unquote, by whichever of the two sides suffered the less damage, irrespective of whether the entire planet and ultimately all life will then have actually been destroyed by the exchange. That comes from the article, Trump Plays Nuclear Chicken with Putin Over Syria, by Eric Zeus, posted June 28th. Imagine how effective Woodward and Bernstein would have been in bringing down Richard Nixon had they been able to publish their Watergate investigations only in the French media. That is the situation we have reached now with Hersh's efforts to scrutinize the West's self-serving claims about Syria. As for the substance of Hersh's investigation, he finds that Trump launched 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airbase in April, quote, despite having been warned by the U.S. intelligence community that it had found no evidence that the Syrians had used a chemical weapon, unquote. In fact, Hirsch reveals that, contrary to the popular narrative, the Syrian strike on a jihadist meeting place in Khan Sheikhoun on April 4th was closely coordinated beforehand between Russian and U.S. intelligence agencies. The U.S. were well apprised of what would happen and tracked the events. That comes from the article, Hirsch's New Syria Revelations Buried from View, by Jonathan Cook, posted June 28th, originally appearing at Counterpunch. A report yesterday by the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who broke some of the biggest stories of the Vietnam and Iraq wars showed that Trump bombed Syria on April 4th based upon false pretenses. Specifically, Trump said the Syrian government carried out a chemical weapons attack on civilians, but U.S. military and intelligence officials say that they told Trump there was no evidence for that claim, and they say that what really happened is that Syria bombed Islamic terrorists and that accidentally released chemicals being stored by the terrorists. So how does Trump respond to the report? He doubles down on the bull. That comes from the article, after getting busted for bombing Syria based on a lie, Trump doubles down, threatens to bomb Syria even harder for the same bogus reason. By Washington's blog, posted June 28th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The mainstream Western press seems unrelenting in their portrayal of Ukraine as a free society where democratic freedoms are threatened only by interference from Russia. However, critics of the Kiev government and its so-called anti-terrorism activities in the Donbass appear to be facing intimidation and repression. To share her thoughts about post-Maidan Ukraine, we're joined by Helena Mokrushina. Helena Mokrushina is currently enrolled in the PhD program in sociology at the University of Ottawa and a part-time professor. She holds a doctorate in linguistics and an MA degree in communication. Her academic interests include transitional justice, collective memory, ethnic studies, the dissent movement in Ukraine, the history of Ukraine, and sociological thought. Her doctoral project deals with the memory of Stalinist purges in Ukraine. She traveled to Lviv, Kyiv, Kharkiv and Donetsk in the summer of 2013 to conduct her field research, and she did return again in April of 2015. She joins us now from Gatineau to share her perspectives on the current state of political freedoms in the country. Helena Mokrushina, it's a pleasure to have you on our program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
On May 14th, 2017, President Poroshenko had declared that, quote, never in its entire history had Ukraine had such an unprecedented level of freedom, in particular for journalists, unquote. The U.S.-based watchdog organization Freedom House, while acknowledging the continuation of violence, threats, intimidation, and harassment against media professionals and organizations, states that, quote, Ukraine's media environment has significantly improved since a change in government in 2014 and ongoing reforms continue to strengthen the legislative environment for journalists and outlets, unquote. It should be noted that Freedom House receives generous financial support from, among other donors, Global Affairs Canada, Google, the National Endowment for Democracy, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the U.S. Department of State, the Motion Picture Association of America, AT&T, the Walt Disney Company, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman. I asked Ms. Mokrushina to offer her comments on the changes in press freedoms since the rise of the Euromaidan.
I don't remember the exact position, but I believe Ukraine descended on it. It has one on the lower positions compared to what it was before 2013. Because, you know, we, in spite of what we're hearing in the West under Yanukovych, you know, the press was very critical of him. And they would allow comments and materials that, you know, now I don't see in the Ukrainian press. And, you know, there was one sociological survey of the materials on Ukrainian TV, right, critical of the current president, and the content was very low. It was like up to only 8% of the TV shows that were critical of the president. And we are talking about the mainstream Ukrainian TV, right, stations in Ukraine. So, and there are many examples of journalists being intimidated because with the rise of this right-wing nationalists in Ukraine, the politicians have to take them into account, right? So they cannot ignore them, and they are also even not sponsored, but they are controlled by the security service of Ukraine, right? And when we look at the trials, for instance, of journalists, and I can cite the example of Ruslan Kutsaba. It's a well-known case,
yes.
Right? Or less known cases of journalist Dmitry Vasilets, who was arrested 2 years ago and is still kept in detention just because, you know, he tried to follow the basic principles of journalism, right, covering both sides of the conflict in the Donbas, and he went to Donetsk just to, you know, to find some contacts, just to explore the possibility of covering the conflict on both sides. So upon his return to Ukraine, he was arrested and accused of, under the article that many of the political dissenters in Ukraine are detained, it's treasonry, right, and threat to national security of Ukraine, and he did nothing wrong, you know. He worked, and his colleagues are still working. It's a Channel 17 in Ukraine, and he has a blog, because there is an organization in Ukraine called Center of Freedom of Speech, and it's a NGO, right, that is completely on a voluntary basis. And what they did, they created files of different political prisoners in Ukraine. So what I was reading this before I was preparing for the discussion with you, and Dmitry Verovets, he has a blog on this website, and essentially he writes on pieces of paper, right, and somehow he transfers these letters to his friends who are free, and in one of his letters he was talking about how during the interrogation the security service of Ukraine offered him, in exchange of, you know, so-called confession, that they would withdraw the verdict, the serious verdict, because it's up to 10 years, right, treason, the high treason. So they asked him to provide so-called proof that his colleagues from this channel, they were, you know, promoting separatism and terrorism, and he refused to do so. So these are, you know, serious statement on his behalf, and there are many other examples where. So this is one example, and then there is Yuri Apukhtin, who was very recently he was accused of, again, high treason and public calls to overthrow the constitutional order of Ukraine and creating mass riots, because he in the spring of 2014 he's from Kharkiv, and he's an engineer, and he was a leading researcher, and he was one of the organizers of the anti-Maidan movement in Kharkiv in the spring of in the so-called Russian Spring, right, following the Euromaidan protests, and they kept him up to now in prison again, from every time prolonging this 2 months detention. And now he was accused finally of this treason and of creating mass riots, this is another example of such a case. So the political dissent, you know, in Ukraine is they are intimidated, they are arrested, they are like I said, you know, we have these powerful right-wing so-called volunteers that they intimidate journalists, or they kill them, like the example of Oleg Buzina, and the trial again, no, it's not investigated. Those two members of the this paramilitary right-wing, I can't remember the name anyway, they were arrested and then they were released.
Mm.
And we see the intimidation on behalf of these in private sector and other formations. They appear in court and they, you know, disrupt the work of the judges and they, you know, seeing this and how powerful they are, you know, judges might, some of them just prolong these pre-detention terms because they don't want any trouble, because they can come to their houses, you know, they can, and this is what they did in Odessa, so they many examples like this.
Yeah. Well, I'm reading the Duran. Since January 2015, it says 11 politicians and journalists critical of the Ukraine putsch government have been mysteriously murdered, including Oles Bulizina, who you just mentioned,
yes,
as well,
mm-hmm,
as in July of 2016, Pavel Sheremet, who died in Kyiv when the car he was driving blew up minutes after it was started, you know, kind of looking like something that you'd expect from the mafia. Is there a strong suspicion among not only the journalistic community, but the wider public, that the government critics are being targeted by the state?
Well, among those among the opposition, yes, but we should not forget that, you know, these this information is not very, is not well covered in the Ukrainian media, right? So people might not, it's not exactly on the first pages of printed press or on the websites, right? And those who do, like strana.ua, they try the security service, they try to also to intimidate them and to silence them, right? And we are talking about the editor-in-chief of this internet newspaper Strana, right, .ua, who is one of the leading opposition newspapers in Ukraine. Right, and very recently he was accused of trying to bribe, blackmail a Ukrainian politician, and then they arrested him. And it's a very clear case of, you know, of the intimidation of independent journalists. And I have to admit that in spite of ideological, let's say, divergences with this internet newspaper, there are several Ukrainian journalists that actually stood up to defend him and saying that, you know, we in spite of clearly stating that they disapprove of him and of his materials, but they are they would like to defend the freedom of press. So it's not that it's you know, the political dissent is completely crushed, but it's of course there is this awareness that the freedom of speech in Ukraine is not where it should be. And it certainly does not correspond to the idealistic image that we that one gathers when one reads the Western press.
Could you give us a little bit more detail about that editor-in-chief, Igor Guzva of Strana.ua? I mean, just some background about him and these charges that are brought up and why they just don't hold up in any fair assessment.
Well, Igor Guzva, he's the editor-in-chief, as I said, of maybe the leading opposition news, not opposition, but the internet media critical of the current Ukrainian regime in Kyiv, right? And he, before that, he worked for, he was the editor-in-chief of Sivodnya, which is still published, but he left that media outlet and he founded this one. And it right immediately it became right of a prominent voice critical of the current political leaders of Ukraine. And they do journalistic investigations, right? Good quality political investigations, and all of the materials are grounded. They publish, you know, it's a good investigative journalism they conduct. And these attempts by the Security Service of Ukraine to discredit them started when Onishchenko, who was deputy and a close ally of Poroshenko, he fled to the West and he had some compromising material on Poroshenko, more specifically, for instance, how he would bribe the deputies to collect the necessary number to pass different laws, for instance, in the Ukrainian government. So this internet media outlet Strana was the only one who contacted him, the Sonyshchenko, because he fled to London because he feared for his life, right? And so they started publishing these materials, and since December 2016, Guzhva said when he was arrested, there was an interview by a Russian journalist, Zakhar Vinogradov, with Guzhva, in which, and he says that we record this interview because we know that Guzhva would be arrested, because he saw it coming, right? So he says that these attempts started back in December of 2016, and he thinks that this is a retaliation, you know, for publishing of these materials, of compromising material on Poroshenko. So essentially, they tried to... he had several contacts by the people from the security service of Ukraine, and it really so they came to they really achieved it in well recently in June of 2017 when they accused him of bribery. Of trying to blackmail the Ukrainian deputy from the radical party of Ljashko, and the name of this deputy is Linko, that allegedly Guzhva asked this deputy Linko to pay $20,000 in exchange of withdrawal of material critical material and some compromising material on this deputy from the website of strana.ua. And of course, it's all there are many inconsistencies in this accusation, and it's right, for instance, the security service while announcing that Guzhva was arrested, and the way they arrested him, it was a breach of law, right? Because to break into the premises of a newspaper office, you have to have a
warrant.
Signed by the judge, and they didn't have any. No, and then because several, maybe 10-15 minutes before they broke in, this contact guy between Guzhva and this deputy, he brought a so-called gift. I don't know, it was a wrapped, it was a package, right? And 10-15 minutes after this, police breaks in. One of the main proofs by the police, by the security service, was this video where Guzhva is in a restaurant talking to this contact guy, but from the dialogue it's clear that he's not asking, that the Guzhva is not the one asking for these $20,000, that this intermediary he proposes Guzhva, to blackmail the deputy anyway, and there are many inconsistencies like this. He was arrested, but with the possibility of a bail, so he was bailed out because there is this opposition party in the Ukrainian government called Opozitsiyny Blok, which is the opposition bloc. So many deputies from this bloc volunteered to bail him out from pretrial detention. So he's now back to his duties, and he says that he will continue the fight because it's a clear case of political repression for the independent position of the Strana and a critical position towards the power.
Mm. Now, when we're talking about this kind of repression of journalists, and it sounds like a major concern is anybody who's critical of the fighting in the Donbass. But I'm wondering, just how severe it is. I mean, is there any room for you might say some of the less policy focused criticism, like the simple spoofs or caricatures that we're used to in the West of high officials, is that okay, or is there a chill even there?
No, I don't know, because there is a very popular TV show in Ukraine called the 95th District or 95th Quartal, and this is it's a satirical show, right, that makes fun of politicians, and they did not stop. They changed TV channels several times, but they are still critical of the government, and there are critical publications in Ukraine, but you know, it's moderate, right? It's very moderate. Mm-hmm. And whoever dares to see in Donbass not terrorists and separatists, the official ideology wants it, is looked upon, you know, there are several ways that you could punish such a, if we talk about the media outlets, right? You can see your license recalled. Another way of silencing or just, you know, marginalizing such a view is to, for instance, introducing quotes, right? Because the Ukrainian parliament passed that legislation according to which there has to be 75% content in Ukrainian language on TV channels, right, and 50% on radio stations. So there are ways, and then we have these, what do you call them, these vigilante, right, from the right-wing volunteers, and then there were attacks on the one of the main TV stations, Inter, in Ukraine, who have been also critical, or who covered so-called pro-Russian events in Ukraine, such as Cross March for Peace. You know, because there is this tradition in Ukraine every year that people of the Orthodox Church of Moscow Patriarchate, they march to Kyiv in the summer, right? So just to cover this procession, so it's a cross procession, not march. Even for covering such events, you know, they were criticized. Or for instance, Immortal Regiment in Kyiv and other cities in southeast Ukraine. Right. So, and there were attacks on the building of this Inter TV station in Kyiv, and then, for instance, the license was recalled by the national executive body who supervises the work of all media outlets, right, and broadcasters. So that license was recalled and I'm talking about Radio Vesti in Kyiv, right, as recently as in March of this year. So yes, there are examples, and people who I mentioned the 17th channel, and they actually they don't hold any so-called pro-Russian position. They try to cover again both sides of the, to be objective, right, and they are for peace in Ukraine, and they don't but any such political or media, you know, actor, It comes under fire from these so-called patriotic volunteers, political and social activists, and they just, you know, they are marginalized. Another example is the position of Medvedchuk, who is the leader of the Ukrainian Choice, Ukrainsky Vibir, who also, you know, advocates for peace in Ukraine, and he's involved in the negotiations between Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kyiv, and thanks to him, you know, there was an exchange of prisoners between the two sides, and he people who are members of his organization, they also have been attacked because they wanted to organize a conference in central Ukraine. And they were chased out of the building and called again separatists and terrorists, just because, you know, they try to bring a peaceful solution to this internal conflict in Ukraine.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
My guest is Halina Mokushina. She's based in at the University of Ottawa, and we've been speaking about the situation of the rights and freedoms in Ukraine post-Maidan. Halina, maybe I'll just sort of expand beyond the journalistic sphere and look at some of the other dissident players. I know that there is, for example, there was a story in May of I got this from the Norwegian blogger Pat Stegen. In May 27th, the Galicia court in Lviv recently convicted a 22-year-old communist for 2.5 years in prison because on the victory of Fascism Day on May 9th, they placed flowers on Soviet soldiers' graves and on the tombs of Ukrainian writers from the 19th century. The humanists Taras Shevchenko and Ivan Franko. So people are going to jail for their political beliefs, apparently. I don't know if you can if you care to address that or any other similar situations where people are giving these outrageous sentences, apparently for their beliefs.
Well, I didn't hear about this case, to be honest, but I heard about a case where a student in Lviv was arrested for publishing on Facebook quotes from Lenin. Right, because now after in April of 2015, we have to go a little back in history. Right, the Ukrainian Parliament adopted a package of so-called decommunization laws. Right, and by one of these laws, the communism as an ideology was equaled with fascism and was declared illegal, right? And any symbol, any mentioning of quotes or symbols or anything that related to communism, you know, including the symbols of Soviet flag, for instance, are considered illegal, right? And people can be not jailed but fined for using these symbols, and it's illegal under this new law. Right, but you know, it tells in itself. It tells tons about freedom of opinion in Ukraine, right? And it was condemned by Amnesty International as, you know, a great threat to the freedom of speech and freedom of opinion. And the student, you know, can you imagine a student here in Canada being arrested and accused and then tried for, I don't know, quoting Marx, for instance, on the Facebook, right? And the ridiculous part of this example is that it reminds me of Inquisition times in Spain, you know, when they would burn, God forbid, they don't burn people on those fires, but they burn books, because in the verdict by this judge, they said that one of the of these proofs has to be destroyed, and this is the Capital by Marx, you know, one of the essential works by Karl Marx. So they considered it as a proof of the guilt of this student, and the student, he pleaded guilty in exchange for this. Confession. He was not jailed, right? Because it was what do you call it? A conditional liberation, he was pardoned, so to speak. So this is one example of such a case. Because as I said, under the decommunization laws, using of Soviet symbols is illegal. But, you know, what freedom of opinion are we talking about if we cannot, quote one of the texts, for God's sake? We live in the 21st century, right? Mm-hmm. And we should be free to express our opinions, our thoughts. So this is one example. And then there is another example. There are many examples, you know, of people being intimidated because, for instance, during this immortal regiment, right, we had many cases of right-wing paramilitary assaulting people who wanted just to to commemorate the grandfathers or grand grandfathers who fought in the Great Patriotic War. So there are many examples indeed, which are, to me, they are troubling, because it's this whole decommunization laws are not it's a it's a threat to, it's not a threat, it's a, no, it's the limiting rights of millions of Ukrainians, right, who honor the memory of the, as I said, fathers, grandfathers, and you, for instance, this year in May of 2017, there was two rows of police, right, guarding those people who were just walking onto the streets of Kyiv to lay flowers to the monument to the unknown soldier. You know, I have never seen anything like this in Kyiv for all the independence years in Ukraine. And here you go. You know, it was very sad to see this. It's very troubling.
I'm curious to know what's happening in the academic realm, the schools, the universities. I mean, if you can't even quote Lenin, you know, I mean, what kind of expression of outrage or criticism is coming from those realms, or are there any?
Well, I believe there are. Honestly, I cannot, you know, speak because I didn't really follow from that aspect. But from what I know, I have friends, so if I can call them Facebook friends, and they teach in Kyiv, and they are critical of the Kyiv government. So there is a freedom of certain freedom of speech. It depends, I guess, what city we are talking about and what university specifically we are talking about. But I know of a case, for instance, in Kharkiv University, and it was back 2 years ago, where the my colleague, a professor of sociology, had to step down because he was critical, and, you know, he held essentially this anti-Maidan positions, and he, the leadership, the management of the university had to fire him because one or several of his students actually filed a complaint against him. So they denounced him essentially. And then I know another example. I don't remember where it was, in Odessa or it was somewhere in southern Ukrainian university, where they were watching a documentary about these events in Ukraine and about the so-called Russian Spring. And then one of the students, or several students, again complained to the management of the university of because there were professors who were showing this pro-separatist documentary. Right, and there is another example. I cannot remember the name of that professor in Odessa, also, whose son was killed in during these tragic events on May 2nd in Odessa, and she was also ostracized by these by private sector in Odessa, and intimidated for this anti-Maidan views. So there are cases in academic environment as well, and. But there are, I believe, still, I did not survey all of the university, so I cannot talk exactly, but I know of cases of such, again, this denunciation and complaints by young students, because when we talk about Euromaidan, right, we are the one of the leading forces was this young generation of Ukrainians who grew up in independent Ukraine, right, who don't have such close ties to Russia, I mean, like family ties or cultural ties. So they are not, they are the products of the new independent Ukraine, right? So they don't have the same closeness to Russia.
The Western narrative is that there was so much outrage against the corruption of the Yanukovych regime. So the people rose up in peaceful demonstrations, and they, you know, were determined to bring about their, a change, and that sort of what the, and of course, I mean, as we've reported on this program, I mean, there was that intrusion of all of these violent elements. So it wasn't that this pure mobilization that we're hearing about. But I am curious to know. I do believe that there were a lot, and I do believe there were a lot of people, like regular Ukrainians, who got caught up in that. You know, with legitimate concerns, I would think, about against Mr. Yanukovych. But I'm kind of wondering what happened to those people who are looking for a better Ukraine. I mean, is there no similar mobilizations or any of those similar sentiments being directed toward the current government or people, as you say, just so out of touch with the violence and the intimidation happening towards dissidents that they're oblivious to it. How do you account for the apparent lack of a reverse Maidan within Kiev and other parts of Ukraine?
Well, you know, I'm a cynicist in that regard, and I believe that any social movement, it cannot last, right? Unless you have some regular basis underneath it, meaning some financial support, right? And we should not forget that this Euromaidan, yes, there were masses of ordinary Ukrainians who rose against the corruption, but you know, I don't think it was so much against the corruption as it was against this dream that has been promoted for all these years, you know, about this European paradise. Because when we talk about this this idea of many Ukrainians, that to me, you know, I realized after reading a lot that it was to a certain extent this dream about the lost Soviet paradise, you know, dream about that by joining the European Union, all this misery, all these problems will be solved because somebody will solve them for Ukraine. So that it was this huge dream that Ukrainians saw being taken away from them, you know, by this decision or by Yanukovych. He did not refuse. You know, we often hear that he refused to sign. He just asked for a delay, right? He postponed the signing of the agreement because Yanukovych has never been pro-Russian in the sense of political orientation, right? He continued the Ukraine's course towards the European Union. But he just realized in the last minute, not in the last minute, but let's say almost in the last minute, that this association with the European Union would hurt Ukraine economically a lot. And this is what we see happening now. And he was right. But the problem of the Party of Reason was that they did not pay enough attention to ideology. No, because when we are talking about a social upheaval, right, you need an ideology to mobilize people, right? And the Party of Regions, I read an interview with Mykola Azarov, who is the former prime minister of Ukraine, and he said that one of our biggest mistakes was that we did not pay enough attention to ideology. That they thought that, you know, if they create more or less decent life for masses of people, that would be enough. But it's not enough. You know, and of course, people are now very disappointed. If we look at sociological surveys, the numbers are disastrous for the current political leadership, because the level of trust is very low towards any kind of power, whether we talk about the parliament, or the judiciary, or the police, especially towards Poroshenko. You know, his level of support dropped below 5%, so it's even lower than Yanukovych had. And we see over 80% of Ukrainians are disappointed with the current situation and think that Ukraine is not going in the right direction and that things are not getting better, they are getting worse and worse. So there is this disappointment that was there also after the first Orange Maidan, right, in 2004. But to have this Maidan, you know, you have to have financial support, right? And financial support comes where? It comes from politicians who are in opposition to the current government, right? And there are none. Mm. So without this financial support from oligarchs, right, because this Maidan was supported to a large extent by Ukrainian oligarchs who were unhappy with Yanukovych, because Yanukovych's attempt to bring under his control and his family control of resources in Ukraine, right? So this was one of the elements of that Maidan. But if you look at, again, I don't remember the exact numbers, but Ukraine descended even more in terms of corruption, because according to Transparency International, Ukraine, you know, this country, in the second 100 of countries who are the most corrupted, right? And these indicator did not improve, meaning that Ukraine, you know, lowered even more its position on this rating of corrupted countries. So if you look at these indicators that were before Euromaidan and after Euromaidan, nothing improved, really. So it's the of course disappointment is there, but and discontent is there, but there is no political force that would step in and mobilize, right? So I don't think we'll see a second or a third Maidan, because if we look at the protests in Ukraine, right, there were many protests essentially by workers, by academics, by scientists, by workers, but they don't move anywhere because there is no unifying political force that would bring those people together and really create a massive movement. So unfortunately, I don't see anything in the near future.
Halina Mokrishina, who's you're an academic based at the University of Ottawa, PhD candidate. You are part of the Ukrainian diaspora.
Well, I used to be.
Oh, used to be.
I'm not anymore.
Yeah. Are you comfortable? I'm just because it seems like there's a lot of intense support for the Ukraine government within Canada and within the Ukrainian diaspora. And somebody who used to be part of that, I'm wondering. How if you could possibly comment on maybe some of the challenges of engaging people in your longtime friends and neighbors on this topic and just trying to
I don't know, Michael. You touched a very very difficult.
That's a difficult one.
I can talk about it because actually it will. Thank you for asking that question because it's a very personal question, right? Because I was involved. I was part of this diaspora, and I still love it for its engagement in Ukraine, for its genuine desire, you know, to see the life of Ukrainians improved. When I started following these events on Euromaidan and I saw where it was going, I said that you are doing, you cannot just support one side and you ignore this pro-Russian Ukraine, right? I felt like Cassandra. It's not a very pleasant feeling, but this is how I felt when I remember it was, I believe, in mid-February when I sent out an email to my colleagues from the Ukrainian National Federation here in Ottawa, saying that, there is this violent element within Euromaidan movement, and violence breeds only violence. But it has fallen on deaf ears because it's all about democracy, right? About this very naive, not to say stupid, mythology about popular revolution. It's only part of the truth, right? But we should not forget that the active part, the nucleus of the Ukrainian diaspora, active Ukrainian diaspora here, are children and grandchildren of Western Ukrainians, right? Who came to Canada after the Second World War, and then their parents were deported by Soviets to Siberia. They were killed. They have this very negative, very memory about the Soviet Ukraine, and they are nationalistic, right? And they are followers. Among them are followers of Bandera and Shukhevich, who are now venerated in Ukraine as national heroes, but who are murderers, right?
Nazi collaborators. Yeah.
Exactly. And I did not realize that, you see, because for me it was in the distant past, but, past never passes, as one of the French historians said. And then that memory comes back very powerfully, and they just, they hate Russia so much and pro-Russian Ukraine so much, it blinds them. They don't see, because we talk about the Soviet Ukraine, right? And I'm part of that Soviet Ukraine, and it's a mixed bag, right? There were bad things, there was famine, there were repressions, but there were also bright sides, right? There was this social security, there was free medicine, there were many good things in that society. But these leaders of the Ukrainian diaspora, they refuse to see it, right? They don't see it. So it's very difficult. I don't know. I still have to. I had to step down because I realized that any new discussion with my colleagues would turn out in a fight in a and I just stepped down. And since then I started writing because for me it was a way of saying what I think about the because I deeply care about Ukraine. I care also in the same way as the Ukrainian diaspora does. But I'm a political, I guess, dissident myself.
So feel like a lone voice, eh?
Exactly. Well, I would really love to find other Ukrainians who think like me. I found some in Ukraine, but I don't know a lot of Ukrainians here in Canada who think like I do, and that's the big problem because Ukrainian Canadians are a powerful voice in Canada. And they, like I said, I admire them for their love for Ukraine and for their determination and all. But they made a series of mistakes, I believe, and now we are unfortunately in an irreparable situation. And we see this worsening of relations with Russia. I don't have any optimistic outlook in the near future. I don't know. I just maybe at some point this love for my country of origin will become. I'll find a way, but for the time being, I just keep. I just stand by myself, and I don't know where it will lead me. We will see. But it's a very difficult situation because after that trip to Ukraine in April of 2015. With my colleague, what they did, I don't know if it was the security service of Ukraine or people who are close to those circles, they broke the correspondence with the people from the Donetsk People Republic, right? And there is this horrible website called Peacemaker. I don't know if you heard about this website.
No.
No, but it's essentially a website where they publish personal data of people, of journalists. There was a huge scandal last year when they published the databases of all foreign journalists who worked at some point in Donetsk, over 5,000 names. And there was a big scandal because this website is sponsored by the Security Service of Ukraine. And the official sponsor of this website is the counselor of the Ministry of the Minister of Interior of Ukraine, the Herashchenko. So they published, may publish, it's an open access, the phone numbers, names of all foreign journalists who at some point worked in Donetsk, including, leading mainstream Western media. So the OSCE reacted and the Council of Europe reacted, asking to close this website. They closed it temporarily for several days, and then they reopened it because it's some kind of a vigilante website where they publish names of all people, not only journalists, who are critical or who hold the separatist or terrorist views, and who. So this website it's a scandal, right? Because it breaches the law on privacy, and any Western country in existence of such a website would be unthinkable. So what they did, these guys, they broke the correspondence of I believe she was called at that moment the Minister of Information or something, and they got hold of our passports, of myself and my colleague from Vancouver, Roger Annis, you interviewed him.
Mm-hmm.
So now our passports are in open access on the internet. The copies of the first two main pages of the passport with name, with date of birth, and the passport number, right? And they are accusing us of, I'm accused of, crossing illegally the border because we went to Donetsk through the Russian border. It is illegal indeed, but it's and they accuse me of manipulating the socially important information.
Oh, goodness.
No, just because I went to the end, because I interpret these events in Kyiv differently. You know, it doesn't help neither. And I contacted my MP office, but they didn't know what to do with me. Because they didn't come across such a situation. So I tried to, you know, I contacted them, and then I said, you know what, I'll just drop this whole issue altogether, because now I cannot go back home. To Ukraine, because I don't know, I might be arrested when I cross the border. Because one of our colleagues who wanted, there were several tours, right? Five tours, I believe. And it was organized by a Russian, German NGO. And one of the colleagues who went with us on that tour, he warned us. He said, you know, I would disadvise you to travel to Ukraine. You should keep away from Ukraine. And, you know, can you imagine, my whole family is in Ukraine. I mean, I have only my immediate family here, but all of the rest is in Ukraine. And now I cannot, I do not dare going there, because I don't know. You know, when I see all these stories of political dissenters being jailed, I don't know what to expect. So to me, it says a lot about freedom of speech in Ukraine. You know?
Yeah, well, I think that personal anecdote really says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So there is nothing more to add, you know, about... I wish, and it hurts, of course, because I was the only Ukrainian, you know, who went on that trip. I went on that trip because I cared, you know, and it was a difficult trip for me. Because I saw, you know, I could never imagine that a war would break up in Ukraine. But then, you know, why Ukraine would be different from other countries where we see civil war and people killing each other. So it's a very,
This is
where we are.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very tragic situation.
It is, and I don't see any, to answer your question, if I will reconcile with the Ukrainian diaspora, the one venue that I would work with them, it would be on the reconciliation. You know, that I would really, I would happily participate in any such effort, but I don't know. I might not, but because I don't see any change of position within the Ukrainian diaspora. So it's we'll see what the future brings. You know, who knows? Maybe these forces within Ukraine will mobilize. I doubt it, but at least I still have hope, because there are many Ukrainians, you know, within Ukraine who are working on who see what's happening and who. Try to do something to bring this country back to peace.
Well, Halina Mokrushina, I want to thank you very much for being so generous with your time, and wish you well going forward, and look forward to reading more of your articles on the newcoldwar.org and other sites.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you for having me and for listening to all I had to say. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. We've been speaking with Halina Mokrushina. She's a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Ottawa and part-time professor, and she joined us from Gatineau.
You can find more of Halina Mokrushina's writing on the website newcoldwar.org. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour will be on hiatus for the summer break. For the next few weeks, we will supply special programming for CKUW and our various affiliates, as well as to the site globalresearch.ca. Our regular season will resume in September. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.